You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So here's the thing. On a little bit before October 5th, Dick Cheney, the vice president, met with a bunch of Republican senators and said, you know, I don't like the fact that this Patriot Act is taking so long to go through Congress. He said, it's going too slowly. I want it passed. Let's try to get it through by October 5th. This is October 5th, 2001. So that's Cheney's deadline. Well, guess what? It wasn't passed by October 5th. And the two guys most responsible for holding it up were Daschle and Leahy. So then guess what? Somewhere between October 6th, the day after that deadline, and October 9th, somewhere within those 3 days, two anthrax letters are sent to, guess who? Daschle and Leahy.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. Graham McQueen taught in the Religious Studies Department of McMaster University in Ontario for 30 years. In 1989, he became founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster and oversaw the development of peace-building projects in Sri Lanka, Gaza, Croatia, and Afghanistan. He is a co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel, and was on the organizing committee of the 2011 Toronto hearings on 9/11. He is the author of The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. Today we discuss the intimidation of elected representatives in both the United States and Canada as a core feature of the war on terror. Graham McQueen, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Bonnie.
How would you describe the initial reactions of the United States Congress to explosions in the Twin Towers on September 11th?
Well, as far as I know, members of Congress specifically didn't talk about explosions in the towers, although in my opinion, that's what brought them down. But certainly members of Congress reacted to the destruction of the towers and to the fact that someone rushed into their rooms where they were watching all this stuff unfold on TV and said, you got to evacuate the Capitol. You've got to evacuate the whole building because it looks like there's a plane headed our way. And according to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, that was the first time in history that the entire Capitol had been evacuated in that way. And there didn't seem to have been any protocol as to how to do it. He says it was, quote, total chaos with, you know, senators and House members scattering in all directions in fear. So that's why this was a major act of terror, or if you like, deliberate intimidation of Congress. Imagine them having to flee the building in which they meet. It's symbolic of the representatives of the United States population meeting together to deliberate and make laws. So, you know, regardless of whether it was explosions or something else that destroyed the towers, and we could talk about that later, this 9/11 incident certainly caused intimidation of Congress.
What is a pattern that is common in societies experiencing danger?
Well, one of the patterns that I'm drawing attention to these days, and I'm certainly not the inventor of this idea, it's been around for a long while, I use the acronym TUR, TUR, to symbolize threat, unity, and response, or as sometimes I say reaction, but let's say response. Threat, unity, and response. So in other words, some threat appears on the scene. The group or society in question is intimidated, they're frightened, and they therefore draw together. That's what unity is about. They pull together like a herd threatened by a predator. And indeed, we see this in communities of non-humans, not just humans. They draw together, and there are a lot of implications there. Civil liberties often go out the window. Dissent is often repressed. And in fact, this unity is usually a hierarchical unity, not an egalitarian unity, hard to distinguish from obedience. So normally the executive branch of the government or the military, whoever at that point is claiming to be the leader, gets to do what they want, and everyone else huddles behind them, grateful for their protection, grateful to have security. That's what I mean by unity. And then response can be of various kinds, but I'm especially interested in two kinds. One is the repression of dissent, which I just talked about. Oh, let's pass a new law, making it more difficult for people to maintain their traditional civil liberties. Let's give more power to intelligence agencies and police and the executive branch. That would be a response that concentrates on the domestic scene, the inside of a society. The other kind of response is external or international, and that's when the society says, somebody did this to us. Some foreign agency or power or entity. So now, having drawn together as a herd, you know, and we're now strong and united, we will hurl ourselves at this external enemy. And that's usually what we mean by war. That's an act of aggression, that's armed force usually, which we then direct toward the person that we think is the enemy, or that we imagine as the enemy, whether they are or aren't. So in other words, threat comes first, then a powerful unity, a herd sense, which then leads to a twofold response, both domestic and international. That's the pattern I'm interested in right now, and I'm especially interested in when it's done to the elected representatives of people, Congress, Parliament, that sort of thing.
You have written that there is a pattern common enough in war and found in the war on terror, threat, followed by unity, followed by reaction, which has an internal and external dimension, which you've just mentioned, the sacrificing of civil liberties and then outwardly attacking enemies. Could you talk about unity, particularly with regard to the United States Congress on September 11th, 2001? What signs were there immediately that Congress was, both sides of Congress, were drawing together in an act of unity?
Right. Well, after they fled in chaos and confusion from the Capitol and went in various directions, many members of Congress gathered later in the day on the steps of the Capitol outside, and there was a podium set up and speeches were made. And the typical, you know, the theme was, as political elected leaders usually say on these events, we will not be intimidated, we will stand up to this threat, we will never allow ourselves, etc., etc. And included in that were lots of statements of unity. We will gather together regardless of our typical disagreements, regardless of what party, regardless of whether we're Senate or House of Representatives, we will gather together under the President of the United States. So that's the statements of unity. And then when they had finished making these statements, and by the way, one of the speakers was Senator Tom Daschle, who was Senate Majority Leader. He's one of the few people who could have thrown a monkey wrench into the works of the Bush administration, because the Democrats actually had a majority in Senate, and he could have blocked both the resolution on the use of force, which would allow the U.S. to do warlike things, and he could have also blocked the internal act, the so-called Patriot Act coming up, at least in theory. Could have given them a lot of trouble. But there he is. He's convinced the whole 9/11 story was genuine. He's hoodwinked like most everyone else. He's standing at the podium. He's been won over. He wants to unite under the president. And in fact, Daschle says he had never experienced such a powerful sense of unity in his life as he did on 9/11. We were one big family, he said. Well, that's a classic statement of unity. And then after he's finished his speech and all the speeches are finished, they're starting to drift away. And clearly some people feel that's not enough. We need some ritual affirmation of unity. And so somehow or other in the crowd, still on the steps, the singing begins. God bless America, our home, sweet home. So I don't have any problem with the fact that they're singing it. But it's remarkable to watch because we have a record of this on video. And this is such interesting, important historical footage. In scattered little groups, they begin singing it. And on they go. And they all know the words and they all sing it. And then they hug each other and everything else. And this, again, I don't want to make fun of them. This is what human groups do under threat. They're clearly moved. They're clearly feeling unity as a family. But what I want to point out to people is that although this is very natural, there's nothing wrong with it inherently, what you're in at that point is you're in an emotional state, and the critical part of your brain isn't necessarily working really well. And in fact, if people begin to dissent and begin using their brain, begin asking questions, who the heck did this? What do you mean, Al-Qaeda? That's usually not looked upon very favorably. And so you are allowing your own brain, or if you prefer, your mind, to be disabled, if you like, to be put on hold. And that's really dangerous, because if the event, if the whole threat is a fake in some way, if it's a false flag operation, for example, where, you know, a crime has indeed been committed, but not by the perpetrator you're being told, but by someone else, you're in a very vulnerable position. You're singing, you're hugging, you're ready to throw your armed forces against the enemy, but it's the wrong enemy. And you're willing to give up your civil liberties, but it's for the wrong reason, and so on. So this is a moment of tremendous vulnerability for a population at large, but also for the elected representatives of the people.
Well, with regard to the subject of unity, I noticed that you have posted a few photographs of Daschle actually hugging President Bush.
That's correct. That was a few days after 9/11. I believe it was after a big formal church service. And, you know, photographers were snapping pictures, of course, of this, because Bush and Daschle were opponents, and they really had major ideological differences. Daschle is frank about this in his autobiography. And, you know, he was extremely critical of the way the Bush administration had come into power and begun to immediately thumb its nose at international law, for example. And yet here's Daschle. You know, he's caught up in the moment. He wants to be a good patriot. He wants to be a good leader. He wants to do what's right. He believes the 9/11 official narrative. So there he is, hugging his opponent, Mr. Bush. And I think I said somewhere or other, this is one of the most dangerous hugs in modern times, because really that meant, what that symbolizes to me is the Tom Daschle who I respect, but who proposed the resolution on the use of force, and Congress passed it almost unanimously on September 14th, and that gave cover to the Bush administration in its aggression against Afghanistan and even to some extent for its aggression against Iraq. Don't forget that the U.S. Constitution gives the power to declare war to Congress, not to the president, not to the executive branch. And even though presidents seldom seek an official declaration of war anymore, they like to have some degree of cover, some kind of sign from Congress that they're enabled to do this. And that's what they got on September 14th. So the hug with, you know, Daschle partly represents his role in that, but it also represents the fact that he was willing to support this Patriot Bill, the Patriot Act, which was, you know, introduced to Congress very rapidly after 9/11. And, you know, there's a whole other story there, which we'll maybe get into, because Daschle did put up a little bit of a fuss, and and was taken care of, we may say. But that hug, you know, when you see these hugs, that represents a very dangerous unity and a very vulnerable population.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. During times of perceived danger, how are populations and their elected representatives vulnerable to manipulation? You have written that a strong social taboo has been constructed that has hampered awareness of this deception and manipulation. What is this taboo?
Well, first of all, the business about how populations are vulnerable at the exact moment of the attack, I'm giving a very informal account of it. I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a neurologist. And I'm not trying to give a sophisticated account, but basically, we get frightened by threats and we go into a certain part of our mind where we seek reassurance, we seek unity, and the critical mind is not functioning very well. And as I've said, that's dangerous. Now, the thing is that usually doesn't last too long. So, for example, after 9/11, the polls showed that many Americans were willing to suspend their civil liberties and they were willing to hurl themselves at the enemy. However, we know that that doesn't last too long, and the polls showed that, and there was a lot of sign that resistance in the U.S., both in Congress and in the general population, was starting to grow to the Patriot Act, for example, saying, wait a minute, are we giving away our civil liberties? And it was very broad-based. It wasn't just the left. It was people on the left, people on the right, people all over the place were wondering about this, and also some rumblings of anti-war sentiment. So what happens in that case? Well, what happens is that if the executive branch is determined, as I believe it was in the fall of 9/11, to get its war and to get its civil liberties restrictions, it will do its best to maintain the sense of fear, maintain the threat, both against Congress and the general population. And I think that's quite clearly what it did in the case of the fall of 9/11. There were all kinds of reports of threats. The FBI was coming up with stuff. Oh, we're 100% sure Al-Qaeda's going to attack again.
You have reported that members of the U.S. Congress were told by the FBI not to wear their congressional pins publicly or to use their congressional license plates. They were told they must hide their identities as elected representatives. Now, I hadn't heard that before.
Yes, this is very clear. It was reported in mainstream media. And so this was what I'm calling one method of keeping Congress intimidated. You can't go out in public and tell people, right, that you are a congressional member. You might be attacked. And there's barricades around, you know, the Capitol and police tape and all kinds of additional restrictions and rerouting of traffic. All this is going on after 9/11. Then to cap it off, the FBI and Department of Homeland Security and all kinds of people start warning that, you know, there's going to be more attacks, that there's a very strong likelihood that there'll be more attacks, and they could be attacks on Congress. And oh my gosh, they start saying we could even get a biological attack or a chemical attack. And guess what? They did. You know, then the anthrax attacks begin. And then we have anthrax attacks on two U.S. senators. And so what I'm saying is I think it's very clear. My own research indicates it's quite clear that 9/11 was the big shock that created the threat, the unity, and so on. But you have to maintain that. And so the anthrax attacks were like the second punch, you know, 1-2 punch. And they kept up the momentum. They kept up the fear. They kept up the threat. You know, the senators in the Hart Senate building had to abandon the whole building. It was contaminated with anthrax. And they were trying to get the Patriot Act passed by, you know, using various offices in Washington and didn't have access to their own equipment. So under extreme sense of threat and danger, they passed that act. And this is what I'm talking about by keeping up the pressure and keeping up the sense of threat and fear, which then continually disables people's critical mind, puts them in this emotional state in which they're vulnerable.
Now, the anthrax letters were sent to leaders of Congress, specifically Daschle and Leahy, but then the media also received these letters. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Several mainstream media organizations received the letters. And they received theirs first, in fact. And there were some infections that resulted from this. There were five people who died, don't forget. A couple of them were postal workers. Actually, if you look at the anthrax deaths, it seems most, if not all of them, were quite random. These extremely dangerous, sophisticated anthrax spores were put in envelopes and sent through the mail. And there's really no way to tell who would die, but it's pretty clear somebody would. So I think it's quite clear that whoever did that wanted to intimidate the general population of the United States, because, you know, people get mail, right? And there's no way of knowing whether that mail now is going to be contaminated by anthrax. And then here are these poor people, ordinary folks, you know, postal workers, an old lady living by herself, a Vietnamese-American, I forget, nurse's aide or something, Robert Stevens, photo editor. These people suddenly are dying. Many other people are ill. And so this is intimidation of the general population. But then when you get two letters specifically used to target members of Senate who are holding up the Patriot Act, you have to go, wait a minute, what's that about?
Now, Senator Daschle and Senator Leahy were both looking at not supporting the Patriot Act until they got these anthrax letters. Is that correct?
It's partially correct. Let's first of all not portray them as great resistors. They were both, as far as I can tell, entirely swindled by the 9/11 attacks, and they both agreed that legislation such as the Patriot Act was necessary, and they had both said they were committed to getting it passed. However, they did want changes in it. Remember that Patrick Leahy was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was his job to look at any legislation. It was the job of his committee to look at any legislation that might threaten the civil liberties of Americans, and to consider it in his committee and to raise objections and propose changes as necessary. And that's what he was trying to do. So what he said publicly is, I'm committed to the legislation and I'm committed to working night and day to get it passed as quickly as possible. But if we don't scrutinize it and go slow, you know, and go carefully, as he put it, the terrorists win. In other words, if they're trying to attack our democracy, they'll be successful if we gut our own democracy. So he was trying to slow Ashcroft down. He was trying to slow Bush and Cheney down. And he did that at a crucial moment. And his colleague, Tom Daschle, who had the very important position of Senate Majority Leader, supported Leahy. So here's the thing. On a little bit before October 5th, Dick Cheney, the vice president, met with a bunch of Republican senators and said, you know, I don't like the fact that this Patriot Act is taking so long to go through Congress. Now, of course, that's absurd because it was actually proceeding much more quickly than most legislation. But he said, it's going too slowly. I want it passed. Let's try to get it through by October 5th. This is October 5th. 2001. So that's Cheney's deadline. Well, guess what? It wasn't passed by October 5th, and the two guys most responsible for holding it up were Daschle and Leahy. This is all clear. It's all said in the Washington Post at the time. All you have to do is read the paper. So then guess what? So this is the October 5th deadline is missed because of two guys. So then somewhere between October 6th, the day after that deadline, and October 9th, somewhere within those 3 days, two anthrax letters are sent to, guess who? Daschle and Leahy. And when I say anthrax letters, I mean letters that have an explicit written threat hand-printed inside, and they also contain spores of anthrax, highly sophisticated, weaponized anthrax, which could, in theory, kill not only these guys, but a whole bunch of other people. Now, it's not rocket science here. Cheney gives a deadline. Two guys are responsible for that deadline not being met. Both those guys and nobody else in Congress immediately get anthrax letters sent to them. Not rocket science here. Pretty obvious what's going on. The fact is the anthrax attacks were crucial in getting the Patriot Act passed. And there was also, during the anthrax attacks, a really serious attempt to not only claim Al-Qaeda did it, but to claim that Iraq had backed Al-Qaeda, and therefore it was also being used to promote war against Iraq. So these anthrax attacks were by no means trivial. They were really important in keeping up the momentum.
You have described our elected representatives as domesticated. How do you mean?
Well, domesticated, I don't remember how I used the term in the first case, but I would say this. Domesticated in two senses. First of all, when this kind of threat happens, they're told, it's okay, we will take care of you. You are, so to speak, a domesticated animal being looked after by the executive branch and the associated intelligence agencies, military-industrial complex. You don't strike out on your own here. We look after you. Domesticated in that sense, but also domesticated mentally in that they accept the limits to their imagination and to their thinking, which are imposed upon them. So, for example, it's not just the U.S. Same thing happened in my country, in Canada. A so-called terrorist event happens, and you see that the most obvious questions are not being asked. At least they're not asked publicly by members of Congress or members of Parliament. They may talk about it over coffee. They may know more than they let on. But at least publicly, even when the two senators who were in the best position to hold up the Patriot Act, those two and nobody else in Congress suddenly get anthrax letters when they start holding up the Patriot Act, the most obvious question should have been asked in the media and in Congress. Hey, who's targeting these particular guys? This looks kind of fishy. Why would Al-Qaeda want to go after guys who are holding up the Patriot Act? Why would Iraq want to do that? It doesn't make any sense. Yet, for the most part, they don't ask these obvious questions because it's taboo to even imply that your intelligence agency or your executive branch might be complicit in these attacks. It's taboo in the United States, it's taboo in Canada, and it appears to be taboo in general in countries in the West.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You have spoken about the physical intimidation of elected representatives as a core feature of the war on terror. You cite the U.S. Congress in September of 2001 and also two different incidents in Canada in 2013 and 2014. I'd like you to talk about these incidents in Canada and their striking resemblance to what went on in September of 2001 in the United States. Let's start with the incident in Canada in 2013. What happened there?
Okay, well, if we want to look at the pattern of what happened here, we have to realize that both the federal police, if you want to call them that, in the U.S. and Canada are both playing a game which is clearly intended to keep the war on terror, which is a fraudulent construction, to keep it going. And one of the ways they do this is by encouraging people, usually marginal, poverty-stricken people, sometimes with drug addiction, sometimes minor prison records, sometimes mentally retarded, any number of things. They target them and draw them into terrorism plots, encourage them, give them money, weapons, self-esteem, ideas, and then they nab them and say, oh, look, we caught a terrorist, and put them away for years and years. So this pattern in the U.S. has been described very well by Trevor Aronson in his book The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror. And I really encourage people to get that book, Trevor Aronson. It's a good piece of research because he looked at every court case from 9/11 until I think it was 2013 when he finished his research, every court case where someone was on trial for terrorism, and read them and came to the conclusion that the FBI was in fact setting these people up again and again and again in order to keep this war on terror going. Well, the thing is that my federal police, the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, are into the same thing. Possibly they're copying the FBI. Maybe they think they're doing it on their own. So the case you're asking me about in 2013 is a classic case of this. We have a couple living together, John Nuttall and Amanda Carodi, and they are poverty-stricken young people living in Vancouver in British Columbia, recovering heroin addicts, trying to get their little lives together and not doing a very good job. And at some point along the way, they seem to self-convert, although this is a bit mysterious, to Islam, and decide that they're Muslims. And the guy, John Nuttall, begins talking about the need for jihad and so on. He's a fantasist. There's no indication he is capable, mentally or physically, of carrying out a real act of terrorism, but he likes thinking about it. So he gets, at least according to the narrative I have, reported to the police by the local mosque, which wants to have nothing to do with him. And the police decide, the RCMP decide to set up this elaborate scam, really, which goes on for a long time and involves over 100 RCMP officers. So they do what the FBI normally does. They dress people up as Muslims, and they send them to Nuttall, this guy, and they encourage him, and they buy him a suit, and they tell him he's a good guy, and they start giving him all kinds of ideas, because his terrorism ideals are hilarious. He would never be able to do anything. He wants to fire rockets at Seattle. He wants to, you know, hijack a train, which no longer exists. I mean, they're pure fantasy. And the RCMP knows their fantasy, actually. If you listen to the audio tapes, they know that this guy is just somebody who watched Rambo 3. But they nonetheless, they're determined to entrap this couple. So finally they say to Nuttall, they ball him out to the point where he begins to cry, pretending to be Muslim and saying he has to get serious about his terrorism. So they say, why don't you use a pressure cooker bomb like they did in the Boston Marathon bombing? Don't worry about how to build it. We'll tell you. Don't worry about getting explosives, which he had no access to. We'll get it for you. Pretending all the time to be Muslim friends, of course. And meanwhile, Nuttall is starting to have reservations. He says to them, hey, I'm not a murderer. I need some spiritual guidance. All this stuff is on tape, by the way, because this trial went on and on. And finally, they not only help him construct these pressure cooker bombs, although they give him insufficient explosive to do any damage, they then say, hey, we'll drive you around town to find you a nice place to put them. And they find a nice place behind a bush at the British Columbia provincial legislature, okay? And then they arrest them. Well, this comes under the category of intimidation of legislatures. Here is supposedly a bomb which is going to go off right next to the legislature, and also it's going to go off on the national holiday, Canada Day, where there'll be civilians walking around with their kids. And so this was a classic entrapment case. The FBI does it all the time. RCMP has done it a few times. It went to trial. The jury, to my disappointment, found them both guilty of terrorism. But the judge, a woman named Catherine Bruce, had serious reservations. And she decided she was going to look at this more closely because it looked like an entrapment case. And a few months ago, she came out with her decision and she stayed the proceedings. She said, "This is no good. It's not acceptable." Let me quote her words. Because she wrote a long report, which is available on the internet. Quote, "The world has enough terrorists. We do not need the police to create more out of marginalized people who have neither the capacity nor sufficient motivation to do it themselves." And so on and so forth. Now, the police are, you know, reacting, and they rearrested them, and they're appealing the case and so on. But I think her decision could become very important in helping to draw a line here. But I hope you see how that 2013 case fits what we're talking about here. Here are two Muslim terrorists with great fanfare. They're caught. Their pressure cooker bombs are shown. Pictures of them are shown in the news. Oh, my gosh, they would have blown up civilians and also part of the BC legislature. This is where representatives of people come in. So this kind of event can not only intimidate the BC legislature, it can intimidate all legislatures across the country in Canada, including Parliament in Ottawa. Everybody will now have to increase their security, make it more difficult for civilians to have access to their elected representatives. So, but you get the idea. That's what happened in 2013. And the only good news here is that at the moment, it's been an embarrassment for our federal police, and it's not clear they're going to come out of this looking good.
Well, I can't help but be struck by the fact that Canada Day, July 1st, 2013, when this incident that you've just been describing took place with these pressure cooker bombs, the so-called Boston bombings took place April 15th of that same year, and the claim is that there were pressure cooker bombs. Now, this is just too big of a coincidence.
Well, it is. It isn't a coincidence, and there are a couple of things worth noting here. First of all, the police agents who were trying to entrap John Nuttall said very clearly, "You are not capable of hijacking a train." Okay, let's get real. Here's what you can do. You can, with our help, build a pressure cooker bomb, just as they did in the Boston Marathon bombing. So, the Canadian federal police are building upon this American case, which also, in my view, looks like another, you know, intelligence operation, by the way, the Boston Marathon bombing. So the intelligence agencies are working together. And by the way, we know they do that. We know the FBI and the RCMP work together often in these cases. That's the first thing to note. The other thing to note is that the Boston Marathon bombings didn't just have a big effect in the U.S. They also had an effect in Canada, and they were used as a pretext to pass legislation in Canada restricting our rights. So again, the effect of these things across borders is very important to think about.
Gee, I didn't know about that legislation in Canada. What is that?
Well, as I recall, this is a bit complicated, but I'll try and sum it up. After the 9/11 attacks, a piece of legislation was passed in Canada in December of 2001, and I don't remember the title of it, but something like anti-terrorism legislation, which clamped down on Canadian rights and gave more power to intelligence agencies and so on. The Liberal government at the time had the good sense to put a sunset clause in to say, in other words, this will lapse automatically unless it is deliberately renewed after a certain period of time by Parliament. Well, that deadline came and Parliament didn't renew it, much to the disappointment of the later Conservative government of Canada, which really wanted that legislation. So, and I believe I'm getting this straight. It's possible I'm getting it wrong, but I think I'm getting it right. The Conservative government finally got its opportunity a few years later to renew that legislation after the Boston Marathon bombings. That gave them the opportunity. The public was scared. Parliament was scared. And that was the opportunity they seized. Now, after the October 22nd, 2014 terrorism incident, which we haven't talked about yet, another even worse piece of legislation was passed restricting Canadians' civil rights, but that's a different story.
Well, Graham, would you like to give us a synopsis of the October 2014 incident? Now, this took place at the Parliament of Canada in Ottawa. What happened there?
Right. Well, October 22nd, 2014, perhaps I should say that week in Canada was quite remarkable historically because there were two, quote, unquote, terrorism events that happened in rapid succession. On what I believe was a Monday, October 20th, an apparently Muslim guy with the big beard and the outfit and so on got in his car and ran down two Canadian soldiers. One was injured and one died. Okay, that was on October 20th. 2 days later, October 22nd, another terrorism incident happens where another apparent Muslim by the name of Michael Zihaf Bibo. You can put all that in quotes because our knowledge of the event is almost entirely from the federal police, whom we obviously can't trust. But for the moment, let's assume it's true. Michael Zihaf Bibo, Muslim, first of all, gets out of his car with a rifle and shoots at two Canadian soldiers who are on duty, ceremonial duty, with empty rifles at the National War Memorial in Ottawa, which is just a short walk from Parliament. He takes out his rifle. He shoots one of the men, Corporal Cirillo, who then dies. He tries to shoot a second guy, but the guy evades the shots, manages to get away unharmed. Then he runs, gets in his car with his rifle. He drives as far as he can toward Parliament, and then there's bollards there where he can't drive any farther. So he gets out of the car, and he runs onto the grounds of Parliament with this rifle and a little bandana over his face and his long hair and beard flowing. He hijacks a ministerial car, which is not far from Parliament. In other words, he tells the driver to get out or he'll shoot him. He gets in the car with his rifle. It's hard to say all this without laughing. He drives that car right past two federal police cars, two RCMP cars, which are stationed there, neither of which does anything to impede him. They then follow him in their cars as he drives directly to the entrance to the main Parliament building called Center Block, where the Canadian Parliament meets. He then gets out of that car, runs into the building with a loaded rifle, and runs down the central hall called the Hall of Honor. Now, on one side of it is the Prime Minister of Canada with his Conservative caucus around him. They formed the government at the time. This is behind an unlocked door. On the other side of the Hall of Honor is the official opposition, the NDP, having their meeting, also unlocked door. So this is considered, for obvious reasons, the greatest security breach in the history of Parliament. Here's this guy with a loaded rifle running down the hall. He could have, in theory, killed a bunch of parliamentarians. Well, the fact that he even got that far is astonishing. Managed to get in the front door, managed to get past the guards. Eventually, they pull out their pistols, the guards, and begin firing at him. And within 2 minutes, he's dead. And there's a whole other story that I could talk about there. Perhaps if we have time to go threat, unity, and response, we can go through those stages, but that's the summary of the incident. He does not, in fact, kill anybody, does not shoot anybody in Parliament. There's one guard that's slightly wounded by a ricochet, but he doesn't shoot anybody. He himself is brought down quite quickly. That, in a nutshell, is the incident.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And what was the reaction by the authorities to this incident?
Well, of course, just as U.S. Congress was thoroughly intimidated on 9/11 and fled in all directions, here we have members of Parliament stuck behind closed doors, which aren't locked, hearing a huge amount of gunfire happening right outside the doors. I mean, as far as we can tell, 59 shots are fired very rapidly. They don't know who's there. It could be a team of guys with assault rifles. So they're scared, naturally. They're thoroughly intimidated. And that's in my little threefold pattern here, threat, unity, response. That's threat. And they were certainly scared. They did not hesitate to say so. They were also then grateful to the security services who saved them. And in the end, the terrorist, in quotes, Zihaf Bibo, was killed by two guys, one of whom was the head of security for Parliament, for that building, a man by the name of Kevin Vickers. Now, Vickers happened to be not only the head of security, but also a symbolic figure who, in a fancy uniform, he carries the mace into Parliament. And if he doesn't do that, Parliament can't meet. So he's a crucial guy, and he's familiar. So then we have this brilliant piece of video footage from the day after this event, in which he brings the mace into Parliament. We're talking about a symbolic object that he carries, which looks like a huge cudgel. It comes from British parliamentary traditions, a very old tradition. So he carries this big kind of gold-plated thing, and he's all dressed up in robes, and that's what he carries into Parliament. Well, just imagine how grateful members of Parliament are. This is the guy who saved them. This is the guy who killed the terrorist. So they all rise to their feet and begin to clap. It doesn't matter what party you're in, NDP, Conservative, Green, whatever, you clap. And that's another powerful symbol of unity. It's like Congress singing God Bless America. It's a very similar image. So again, we have unity. And then we have, just as Daschle and Bush hugged, we have famous hugs, which I managed to find photos of the Prime Minister of Canada, Mr. Harper, a very unhuggy man, by the way. He looks so awkward hugging them, but now he does it. He hugs the official leader of the opposition. He hugs Mr. Trudeau, the head of the Liberal Party, who's now the Prime Minister. And we have Mr. Harper, the Prime Minister, giving a little speech about unity and we will not be intimidated and so on. And from that unity, we move over to response. And guess what? Both elements are there again. Domestically, a new bill is introduced, C-51, which infringes on traditional Canadian civil rights and gives more power to intelligence agencies in Canada. And externally, guess what? There's legitimation of a very recent Canadian military presence in Iraq. And they immediately name one of their army bases in Iraq after the soldier killed on October 22nd. And very clear sign that this legitimizes our military mission. So, again, we have threat, unity, and response, and in some ways very similar to the pattern set down in the U.S.
Now, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who were implicated in the 2013 event, as having entrapped these people, they were also in charge at Parliament in Ottawa during the 2014 event.
That's right. They had responsibility for the security of the area of what is called Parliament Hill, not inside the building, but the hill itself. But in fact, what we discovered is that they were way short of personnel. And they had, in fact, terminated some patrols that they'd been taking just a couple of days before this event. And it's peculiar because the head of the RCMP said, oh, we were completely caught off guard by this event. But that's false. I mean, he just lied. There were at least six warnings, and these warnings were quite specific. And, you know, they're all documented. And when I say they're specific, I mean, for example, a man who works for the British Columbia legislature said quite promptly, oh, we got a warning that something might happen this week, meaning a terrorist event. Well, guess what? Something did happen this week. two terrorist events happened that week. That's pretty specific. So as one journalist said, who had a little bit of brains here, he said, if the BC legislature was prepared, why wasn't the national legislature? Why wasn't Parliament prepared? Why wasn't the RCMP prepared? And there are many, many serious questions about how this was handled. And I think if the RCMP were forced into a corner, they would say, oh, well, you know, we didn't have enough funding, and so we didn't respond as quickly as we should have. But of course, there is a much darker option here, and that is that they may have been complicit in this event, just as they set up this impoverished, bearded young drug addict in Vancouver the previous year. They may also have entrapped another bearded, impoverished drug addict from Vancouver, namely Ziaf Bibo, a year later. And that's what I'm worried about. I'm worried about direct complicity by the RCMP and possibly the FBI in entrapping this guy to do the event. And that's the taboo possibility. That's the one you're not allowed to mention in public. That's the one the journalists don't talk about. Parliamentarians don't talk about it. It's okay to say the RCMP may have been incompetent. You know, it's okay to say that Ziaf Bibo may not have been a terrorist. He might have just been mentally ill. You know, that's the kind of liberal position. But it's not okay to say our federal police may have been complicit in this, just as they were complicit the year before in entrapping somebody.
And isn't it also true that the RCMP reported that these so-called terrorists in Canadian Parliament in Ottawa had fired 30 shots and it turned out he only fired two?
Well, that's slightly oversimplified, but you're pretty much on target. In other words, there was an attempt to exaggerate, an attempt, I wouldn't say so much on the part of the RCMP as by some Canadian members of the government who tried to exaggerate the degree of threat that this man represented, that he could have killed all these people. It was as if he'd had a sophisticated assault rifle, which was, you know, recently loaded. This was not true at all. He carried a Model 94 Winchester 3030, a deer rifle, and it was designed in 1894. That's his rifle. It appears to have had two bullets in it, three at maximum, when he ran into the Parliament. And of the 59 bullets that parliamentarians heard, the 59 shots, 56 were fired by the police with 9mm pistols, and the man was hit 31 times. He was finally killed at point-blank range, between 3 and, say, 10 feet, by two guys who fired repeatedly into him, including once he had fallen to the ground, meaning there will be no trial. He's dead. And there has been no call for a public inquiry either. So at the moment, we are completely trapped within the police narrative of what happened.
Do you consider the war on terror in general to be a threat to democracy?
Oh, certainly. It's a threat to democracy in all sorts of ways. But what I've been trying to stress recently in a couple of talks is this threat to representative democracy specifically. So where the executive and the associated intelligence agencies physically intimidates Parliament or Congress, the elected representatives of the people, and gets them to pass various laws which they otherwise wouldn't do. And it's sometimes hard to get people worked up about this because people are often quite cynical already about their parliaments and their Congress. You know, when I talk to most Americans that I know, they kind of go ho-hum when you say Congress was intimidated because they say Congress doesn't represent us anyway. Well, if that's the case, that's a problem. But I still think if our representative democracies are being disassembled in front of our eyes, we ought to take note of that. And it may be one of these cases where you don't know what you've got till it's gone. After all, Congress was not exactly on fire with the spirit of resistance during the Vietnam War, but they did, in the end, deny the executive the funds necessary to continue that war. And that's why that war ended. And we're not seeing anything, even at that kind of low level of feistiness at the moment. So I would say, defective though it may be, the representative democracy we have is better than a straight authoritarian state, which is where I'm afraid we're headed.
With regard to the war on terror, do you see it as the executive branch obviously intimidating not only the legislative branch of government, but also the judicial?
I think that's true. And I think there's also danger, I realize, of oversimplification. You know, what do I mean by the executive branch? I mean, for example, in the case of the Kennedy assassination, it was the head of the executive branch, the president, who was killed. There's no automatic immunity for presidents and vice presidents and so on. But I think what we're seeing in the war on terror specifically on these frauds rather than the frauds of the 60s is that in general the executive branch, and by the way, executive branch doesn't just mean the president, okay, in the United States. It includes the intelligence agencies. It is usually used that term in a way to include the FBI and the CIA and a variety of others as well, the NSA, the DIA. And so these are all considered part of the executive branch, as is the Pentagon. So that's what I'm talking about. That's a hugely powerful set of agencies. And here's poor Congress, the lawmakers elected by the people, up against that mammoth set of institutions and being repeatedly intimidated in all kinds of ways. That's the particular threat. That's the particular danger that I'm highlighting at the moment. And I think that's what we're seeing in the war on terror.
Graham McQueen, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, Bonnie. It's always a delight to be on your show.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show has been The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. Since taking early retirement from McMaster University, most of Dr. McQueen's research has focused on the events of September 11th and the War on Terror. He is a co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel, and was on the organizing committee of the 2011 Toronto hearings on 9/11. He currently serves on the board of directors of the International Center for 9/11 Studies, which has secured the release of numerous photographs and videos held by the U.S. government. Recently, he has completed a report entitled The October 22nd, 2014 Ottawa Shootings, Why Canadians Need a Public Inquiry. He is the author of the 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, available at claritypress.com. That's claritypress.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter, which includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written...
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
For Valentine's Day, we're dusting off a show from February 2009. It has some decidedly kinky music and a great expose of the diamond industry. So put down that Whitman's sampler, turn up the volume, and hugs and kisses to all. Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Valentine's Day is coming to town. Most pinko commie left-of-center radio programs are probably drowning you with stories about how exploitative, polluting, and downright awful the chocolate industry is. But that's not our way. For Valentine's Day, New World Notes wants to promote love, romance, and great S-blank-X with your sweetie, or if that's not possible, with someone else's. So instead of a damning expose of big chocolate, we'll present a tender and heartwarming tale of the diamond monopoly and the U.S. advertising agency that keeps it in business and keeps it in your pocket or your fiancé's, depending on your gender. Lynn Gary gives a fine reading of an article on the subject by Edward J. Epstein. And in between sections, we'll pause for romantic songs of love. In fact, let's start out with one. Tom Lehrer's She's My Girl.
Sharks gotta swim, and bats gotta fly. I gotta love one woman till I die. To Ed or Dick or Bob, she may be just a slob, but to me, well, she's my girl. In winter, the bedroom is one large ice cube, and she squeezes the toothpaste from the middle of the tube. Her hair's in the sink have driven me to drink, but she my girl, she's my girl, she's my girl, and I love her. The girl that I lament for, the girl my money's spent for, the girl my back is bent for, the girl I owe the rent for, the girl I gave up Lent for, is the girl that heaven meant for me. So that tastes like shampoo. I come home for dinner and get peanut butter stew. Or if I'm in luck, it's broiled hockey puck. But oh well, what the hell, she's my girl, and I love her.
An astonishing article I came across quite by accident on the internet that demonstrates how corporations use the PR industry to manufacture ideas of value and even create phony cultural traditions. The article was published in 1982 in the Atlantic Monthly, written by Edward J. Epstein, and titled, Have You Ever Tried to Sell a Diamond? He writes, the diamond invention The creation of the idea that diamonds are rare and valuable and are essential signs of esteem is a relatively recent development in the history of the diamond trade. Until the late 19th century, diamonds were found only in a few riverbeds in India and in the jungles of Brazil, and the entire world production of gem diamonds amounted to a few pounds a year. In 1870, however, huge diamond mines were discovered near the Orange River in South Africa, where diamonds were soon being scooped out by the ton. Suddenly, the market was deluged with diamonds. The British financiers who had organized the South African mines quickly realized that their investment was endangered. Diamonds had little intrinsic value, and their price depended almost entirely on their scarcity. The financiers feared that when the new mines were developed in South Africa, diamonds would become at best only semi-precious gems. The major investors in the diamond mines realized that they had no alternative but to merge their interests into a single entity that would be powerful enough to control production and perpetuate the illusion of scarcity of diamonds. The instrument they created in 1888 was called De Beers Consolidated Mines Limited, incorporated in South Africa. De Beers proved to be the most successful cartel arrangement in the annals of modern commerce. While other commodities such as gold, silver, copper, rubber, and grains fluctuated wildly in response to economic conditions, diamonds have continued, with few exceptions, to advance upward in price every year since the Depression. The diamond invention is far more than a monopoly for fixing diamond prices. It is a mechanism for converting tiny crystals of carbon into universally recognized tokens of wealth, power, and romance. Both women and men had to be made to perceive diamonds not as marketable precious stones, but as an inseparable part of courtship and married life. The illusion had to be created that diamonds were forever, forever, in the sense that they should never be resold. In September of 1938, Harry Oppenheimer, son of the founder of De Beers and then 29, traveled from Johannesburg to New York City to meet with Gerald M. Lauck, president of N.W. Ayer, a leading advertising agency in the United States. Lauck and N.W. Ayer had been recommended to Oppenheimer by the Morgan Bank, which had helped his father consolidate De Beers' financial empire. His bankers were concerned about the price of diamonds, which had declined worldwide. In Europe, where diamond prices had collapsed during the Depression, there seemed little possibility of restoring public confidence in diamonds. Furthermore, Europe was on the verge of war, and there seemed little possibility of expanding diamond sales. This left the United States as the only real market for De Beers diamonds. Oppenheimer and the bankers believed that an advertising campaign could persuade Americans to buy more expensive diamonds. Oppenheimer suggested to Lauck that his agency prepare a plan for creating a new image for diamonds among Americans. In their subsequent investigation of the American diamond market, the staff of N.W. Ayer found that since the end of World War I in 1919, the total amount of diamonds sold in America, measured in carats, had declined by 50%. An Ayer memo concluded that the depressed state of the market for diamonds was, quote, the result of the economy, changes in social attitudes, and the promotion of competitive luxuries, close quote. Specifically, the Ayer study stressed the need to strengthen the association in the public's mind of diamonds with romance. Since, quote, young men buy over 90% of all engagement rings, it would be crucial to inculcate in them the idea that diamonds were a gift of love. The larger and finer the diamond, the greater the expression of love. Similarly, young women had to be encouraged to view diamonds as an integral part of any romantic courtship. Since the Ayer plan to romanticize diamonds required subtly altering the public's picture of the way a man courts and wins a woman, The advertising agency strongly suggested exploiting the relatively new medium of motion pictures. Movie idols, the paragons of romance for the mass audience, would be given diamonds to use as their symbols of indestructible love. In addition, the agency suggested offering stories and society photographs to selected magazines and newspapers, which would reinforce the link between diamonds and romance. Fashion designers would talk on radio programs about the trend towards diamonds that Ayer planned to start. The Ayer plan also envisioned using the British royal family to help foster the romantic allure of diamonds. An Ayer memo said, quote, "Since Great Britain has such an important interest in the diamond industry, the royal couple could be of tremendous assistance to this British industry by wearing diamonds rather than other jewels," close quote. Queen Elizabeth later went on a well-publicized trip to several South African diamond mines, and she accepted a diamond from Oppenheimer. In addition to putting these plans into action, N.W. Ayer placed a series of lush four-color advertisements in magazines that were presumed to mold elite opinion, featuring reproductions of famous paintings by artists such as Picasso, Durant, Dalí, and Dufy. The advertisements were intended to convey the idea that diamonds, like paintings, were unique works of art. By 1941, the advertising agency reported to its client that it had already achieved impressive results in its campaign. The sale of diamonds had increased by 55% in the United States since 1938. N.W. Ayer noted also that its campaign had required, quote, "the conception of a new form of advertising, which has been widely imitated ever since. There was no direct sale to be made. There was no brand name to be impressed on the public mind. There was simply an idea, the eternal emotional value surrounding the diamond. And a new color, diamond blue, was created and used in these campaigns," close quote. In its 1947 strategy plan, the advertising agency strongly emphasized a psychological approach. Quote, "We are dealing with a problem in mass psychology. We seek to strengthen the tradition of the diamond engagement ring to make it a psychological necessity capable of competing successfully at the retail level with utility goods and services," close quote. It defined as its target audience some 70 million people, 15 years and over, whose opinion we hope to influence in support of our objectives. N.W. Ayer outlined a subtle program that included arranging for lecturers to visit high schools across the country. Quote, "All of these lectures revolve around the diamond engagement ring and are reaching thousands of girls in their assemblies, classes, and informational meetings in our leading educational institutions." The agency had organized in 1946 a weekly service called Hollywood Personalities, which provided 125 leading newspapers with descriptions of the diamonds worn by movie stars. In 1947, the agency commissioned a series of portraits of engaged socialites. The idea was to create prestigious role models for the poorer middle-class wage earners. "We spread the word of diamonds worn by stars of screen and stage, by wives and daughters of political leaders, by any woman who can make the grocer's wife and the mechanic's sweetheart say, 'I wish I had what she has,'" close quote. An N.W. Ayer copywriter came up with a caption, "A diamond is forever," which was scrawled on the bottom of a picture of two young lovers on a honeymoon. Even though diamonds can in fact be shattered, chipped, discolored, or incinerated to ash, the concept of eternity perfectly captured the magical qualities that the advertising agency wanted to attribute to diamonds. Within a year, "A diamond is forever" became the official motto of De Beers.
Do so tight as we danced to the Wiener Schnitzel waltz. The music was gay and the setting was Viennese. Your hair wore some roses, or perhaps they were peonies. I was blind to your obvious faults. As we danced across the scene to the strains of the Wiener Schnitzel waltz. Some champagne from your shoe, la la la. I was drunk by the time I got through, la la la. For I didn't know, as I raised that cup, it had taken two bottles to fill the thing up. It was I who stepped on your dress, la la la. The skirts all came off, I confess, la la la. Revealing for all of the others to see just what it was that endeared you to me. I remember the night I held you so tight as we danced to the Wiener Schnitzel waltz. Your lips were like wine, if you'll pardon the simile. The music was lovely and quite Rudolph Frimley. I drank wine, you drank chocolate malts. And we both turned quite green to the strains of the Wiener Schnitzel waltz.
Thank you again, Tom Lehrer. So, the world's most successful cartel ever kept the price of diamonds way high. The English imperialists saw a potentially huge market, but only in America. This potential market was transformed into a real market by a brilliant advertising agency, NWAR, which created a blitz of highly sophisticated and then unusual ad techniques to make diamonds seem desirable, glamorous, an eternal symbol of enduring love, particularly their cash cow, the diamond engagement ring. Even Queen Elizabeth aided the campaign. How many married women do you know that do not wear a diamond engagement ring? And all of the above was first engineered before TV. Then comes the boob tube, and you can imagine the new possibilities. NWAR agency did. Then Russia joined the cartel, and disaster threatened to strike. Here, disaster means lower prices. Can the cartel survive? Let's listen.
In 1951, NWAR found some resistance to its million-dollar publicity blitz. It noted in its annual strategy review, quote, "The millions of brides and brides-to-be are subjected to at least two important pressures that work against the diamond engagement ring. Among the more prosperous, there is the sophisticated urge to be different as a means of being smart. The lower-income groups would like to show more for the money than they can find in the diamond they can afford." Close quote. To remedy these problems, the advertising agency argued, quote, "It is essential that these pressures be met by the constant publicity to show that only the diamond is everywhere accepted and recognized as the symbol of betrothal." Close quote. NWAR was always searching for new ways to influence American public opinion. Not only did it organize a service to, quote, "release to the women's pages the engagement ring," but it set about exploiting the relatively new medium of television by arranging for actresses and other celebrities to wear diamonds when they appeared before the camera. It also established a diamond information center that placed a stamp of quasi-authority on the flood of, quote, "historical data" and, quote, "news" it released. NWAR commented in a memorandum to De Beers, "Because we have done it successfully, we have opportunities to help with articles originated by others," close quote. NWAR proposed to apply to the diamond market Thorsten Veblen's idea, stated in The Theory of the Leisure Class, that Americans were motivated in their purchases not by utility but by conspicuous consumption. Quote, "The substantial diamond gift can be made a more widely sought symbol of personal and family success, an expression of socioeconomic achievement," close quote, N.W. Ayers said in a report, to exploit this desire for conspicuous display, the agency specifically recommended, quote, promote the diamond as one material object which can reflect, in a very personal way, a man's success in life, close quote. Since this campaign would be addressed to upwardly mobile men, the advertisements ideally, quote, should have the aroma of tweed, old leather, and polished wood, which is characteristic of a good club, close quote. Toward the end of the 1950s, N.W. Ayer reported to De Beers that 20 years of advertisements and publicity had had a pronounced effect on the American psyche. Quote, since 1939, an entirely new generation of young people has grown to marriageable age. To this new generation, a diamond ring is considered a necessity to engagements by virtually everyone, close quote. In America, which remained the most important market for most of De Beers' diamonds, N.W. Ayers recognized the need to create a new demand for diamonds among long married couples. Candies come, flowers come, furs come, but such ephemeral gifts fail to satisfy a woman's psychological craving for a renewal of the romance, N.W. Ayers said in a report. An advertising campaign could instill the idea that the gift of a second diamond in the later years of marriage would be accepted as a sign of ever-growing love. The diamond market had to be further restructured in the mid-1960s to accommodate a surfeit of minute diamonds, which De Beers undertook to market for the Soviets. They had discovered diamond mines in Siberia after intensive exploration in the 1950s. De Beers and its allies no longer controlled the diamond supply and realized that open competition with the Soviets would inevitably lead, as Harry Oppenheimer gingerly put it, to price fluctuations, which would weaken the carefully cultivated confidence of the public in the value of diamonds. Oppenheimer, assuming that neither party could afford risking the destruction of the diamond invention, offered the Soviets a straightforward deal, a single channel for controlling the world supply of diamonds. In accepting this arrangement, the Soviets became partners in the cartel and co-protectors of the diamond invention. Almost all of the Soviet diamonds were under half a carat in their uncut form, and there was no ready retail outlet for millions of such tiny diamonds. When it made its secret deal with the Soviet Union, De Beers had expected production from Siberian mines to decrease gradually. Instead, production accelerated at an incredible pace, and De Beers was forced to reconsider its sales strategy. De Beers ordered N.W. Ayers to reverse one of its themes. Women were no longer to be led to equate the status and emotional commitment to an engagement ring with the sheer size of the diamond. A strategy for small diamond sales was outlined, stressing the importance of quality, cut, and color over size. Pictures of 1/4-carat rings would replace pictures of up to 2-carat rings. The news release also made clear that women should think of diamonds, regardless of size, as objects of perfection. A small diamond could be just as perfect as a large diamond. De Beers devised the Eternity Ring, made up of as many as 25 tiny Soviet diamonds, which could be sold to an entirely new market of older married women. The advertising campaign was based on the theme of recaptured love. Again, sentiments were born out of necessity. Older American women received a ring of miniature diamonds because of the needs of a South African corporation to accommodate the Soviet Union. And I've been reading from an article, Have You Ever Tried to Sell a Diamond?, published in the 1982 Atlantic Monthly, written by Edward J. Epstein. So there you have it. How a cartel and an advertising agency used the media to create a phony cultural tradition in the interest of profit. Thank you for listening. And the profit.
1970, The Kinks' Immortal Lola, the rockingest song about transgender love for decades. And thank you for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the fine reading of the Diamond article, many thanks to Lynn Gurry and the Unwelcome Guests Collective. www.unwelcomeguests.net. New World Notes is available off the air by internet stream, podcast, or MP3 download at your convenience. There's an archive of shows you can download. There's also a weekly newsletter and a blog. All is free. For more information, why not start at the blog? We're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed in this program are mine alone, and they are protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. From Darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week, happy Valentine's Day, and advising illegitimi non-carborundum, keep the faith, and please tune in again.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 Wake Up Call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear whistleblower Sibel Edmonds, who has been gagged and classified by the U.S. government, share her story as a translator at the FBI and what she learned there about who's behind terrorism. And what you're about to hear comes from an April 2016 interview with the radio show host Tom Woods. It's episode 629, and you can find it at his website, tomwoods.com. I've edited parts of it here to fit into a 30-minute show. Sibel Edmonds is editor and publisher of Boiling Frogs Post. She's founder and president of the National Whistleblowers Coalition, and she's also behind a new effort at independent media called NewsBud, which you can learn more about at her website, boilingfrogspost.com. And here she is, Sibel Edmonds.
I began my work with the FBI 4 days after September 11, 2001, after the September 11 terrorist attacks, and I served two functions for the FBI's Washington field office, both as language specialist translator for three languages, but also that's Turkish, Farsi, and Azerbaijani. But I also performed analysis because of my background, political background, and knowledge of these countries that were the targets of certain investigations or the operatives from these nations. And that would be Iran and Turkey and several countries within Central Asia and Caucasus, including Azerbaijan, because they also speak various dialects of Turkish language. They are Turkic root languages. And let me just say that I never planned working for the government. I never wanted to work for the government, not only here, but anywhere else in the world. I grew up skeptical of governments, big governments. My father was a known surgeon in Iran. He was taken in and tortured for the kinds of books he was reading and handing out to people. I went through a military coup in Turkey in 1981, implemented by NATO and the United States. And we went through all the martial laws and the curfew. So I have lived in many countries to have this pretty good, strong desire to stay away from the government. The only reason I accepted the job offer, and they basically called and begged me because they said, our country, our nation needs you, Ms. Edmonds. We have had this attack and we are still under attack. There may be more attacks. And with you, we get 3-4 languages covered, plus your background and your analytical skills. I have a bachelor's degree. I have 2 of them in criminal psychology and criminal justice. I also have a master's degree in public policy. So all those kind of were, I guess, attractive to them. And I couldn't say no, because I was just like any other Americans out there. Well, they're telling me this is my chance to serve my country, and really my country, because other countries I lived in, I was either born in them or I lived them because my parents went from one country to another country for my dad's work. They were not by choice my country. The United States, I came here in 1988. I decided, consciously made a decision to become a citizen. So this is my first and only country by country of choice. And I became a citizen by choice, not because I was born into it. So I said, sure. And I was pretty naive. I was very green. I was similar to many Americans that I get to see or hear from. I totally believe what I was given through my education in the United States, master's in public policy. I love the fact that I was living in a country with separation of powers and constitution, bill of rights, the system of checks and balances. Little I knew. I had no idea that these were illusions that were being marketed and sold to the public through the education, academics, and the mainstream media, and of course, Hollywood. So I was one of the believers. I was very green. I believed that they didn't exist only in theory, but that they, in fact, applied. Well, As soon as I started working at the FBI, I came across some major cover-ups on extremely important investigations, not by choice by the agents, but because of the higher-ups in the State Department and people within the CIA, basically hindering the investigations taken by the FBI. In addition to that, I also witnessed incredible level of waste, fraud, abuse. I mean, things that if they were to really put it out there, and it should be out there, and I'm sure many people have tried to put it out there, and it's out there, that what the government does with people's trust and the tax dollars that they are cutting and collecting every month from their paychecks. And to me, that was an eye-opener, not only the cover-ups, but how these agencies were ran. And being an outsider, I was working for them as a contractor and someone who has always believed in the free market and efficiency. My husband and I, we've been married for 25 years. We have had our own business. It was surreal, the level of intentional waste, fraud, and abuse. And with the cover-ups and issues being significant, I tried to bring some of these issues to the attention of higher-ups within the FBI. Well, that was a major mistake because the problem actually was stemming from those higher-ups, the executive-level people. And that began a chain of reaction and retaliation. And then at that point, I said, well, based on what I studied, what I have a master's degree on, there are channels I can pursue. Yeah, I didn't go out there to media and leak documents. I believe there were appropriate channels, so it's my duty to take it to the Inspector General's office and have them look into these issues and do something about it. Well, the Inspector General's office for the FBI, DOJ, they work for the same bosses. So basically, you're going to the same people and asking them to investigate themselves. But hey, they said this is one of the so-called channels. I pursued it. That brought more retaliations. In fact, half a dozen or more agents stormed our house.
Here she's asked, what sort of information had she reported?
In some cases, there were significant, important facts related to counterintelligence investigations by the FBI that were stopped from being pursued via State Department and the CIA. Because the targets of those investigations actually had other working and operative relationship with individuals within the CIA and the State Department. So whether they were notorious criminals, let's say in movement of heroin into the United States from Afghanistan via Turkey and then Belgium, NATO's headquarters, and from there directly into the United States, or terrorism activities sponsored, strategically designed here in Chicago, in the United States, and then with the players being sent to areas in Central Asia, Caucasus, Middle East to execute terror attacks. These people didn't work for Al-Qaeda. They worked together with the CIA and a certain Pentagon units. These were the issues that would not be within the scope of what the FBI agreed. And you could not investigate and do anything about really true investigation of 9/11 without linking and getting linked to players within the United States. And on top of that chain, dealing with the CIA operations and certain Pentagon, joint Pentagon NATO operations overseas that were being handled from the United States. I know it sounds complex. I have received more gag orders than any other person in the history of this country. They invoked the state secrets privilege during John Ashcroft's Justice Department twice in my case. The Justice Department retroactively classified all investigations conducted by the United States Congress in my case. And this is after the United States Congress went publicly on record and they said all my reports and allegations were confirmed by other documents and other witnesses. But the Justice Department said, okay, now they're retroactively classified, your results, the investigation results, and we impose gag order on you.
Here she's asked what the gag order prohibits her from saying.
In short, it means violating Constitution and separation of powers because you can't have the executive branch, the Justice Department, issue gag order via retroactive classification on the other branch, legislative branch, the United States Congress. They basically said, you investigated, you said this, you're going to destroy all these documents, we are collecting everything in your computer. You cannot even refer to Sybel Edmonds because under state secrets privilege, which they did via court, because I also went to court in this case, tried to get the case moving in court so I could bring in witnesses and expose all these massive cover-ups and the consequences of those cover-ups, and for the public's right to know, so the information, the truth would come out. And none of these were justifiably classified. It was not about some ongoing investigations. It was not anything that in any way could have been considered classified. They didn't want the public to know because that would have caused outrage. It would have exposed government's own illegality. Well, with Congress, even though illegal, this retroactive classification and gag order, they abided by it. And from both parties, I am not allowed to discuss the fact that there has been an ongoing operation, and that involves CIA, NATO, and a certain division within Pentagon that implements, creates terror events at home and abroad, whether it's in Central Asia, whether it's by using Chechens, by training and arming them and having them blow up a building inside Russia, whether it is training and directing another group to blow up a certain entity within Turkey, that these operations are not done via what they advertise to be entities such as Al-Qaeda, or in this case, I'm sure it is what they call ISIL or ISIS. When you look at it, these entities, like in 19, my counterintelligence investigations that I was working on with three FBI agents, and these were field level agents, they were good people, these guys. The problem was from the higher ups and the State Department, the CIA. In 1997, for example, we had counterintelligence recording by tapping certain embassies, let's say if it's Turkish embassies, from 1997 records, that had Ayman al-Zawahiri of Al-Qaeda with two very well-known State Department officials, including Mark Grossman, and Prince Bandar meeting in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in an embassy, and on how to bring certain, what they call terrorist groups from Pakistan and from Saudi Arabia into Turkey, give them fake passports and funnel them into the Balkans area, and there for them to have training camps established and opening up mosques, building mosques. Okay. The financing of it partly came from the United States directly, partly from the Saudi Arabia, but also the operation included utilizing the opium grown in Afghanistan region and then processed in Turkey. Turkey is a NATO member, NATO ally country. And then from Turkey being distributed and traveling through Belgium, United Kingdom, and also in the United States. You're looking at terror activities committed by the United States government. You're looking at illegal narcotic operations being actually directed and operated by by entities within the United States government. And yet, the stories being sold to the public being that there are these boogeymen in Afghanistan and there are these boogeymen Islamists in Saudi Arabia, they are independent actors who have come up together and they are terrorists and they hate the way of life we have here in the United States. And lo and behold, they are attacking our interests around the world and in our country. It basically, everything that we had in the FBI contradicted the story being told from the government, by the government to the media, and by the media being sold to the American public. That would be the summarized version of what it involved. Well, that's why the gag orders, the state secrets privilege, in courts, they came before the judges, the Justice Department and FBI attorneys. And they said, even if she's right, she can't talk about those because everything she knows is classified at the highest level. In fact, we want you, judge, and this was Judge Reggie Walton initially, and then it went to the appellate court and to the Supreme Court, Tom. We want you to declare her birthplace, where I was born, her birth date, the languages she speaks, where she has gone to school, like university degrees, all classified. And the judge approved it. The judge said, and this is the exact sentence he said, during these terror situations, who am I as a judge to disagree with the Justice Department and the FBI if they are telling me this will embolden terror and increase our terror, the threats of terror? Therefore, I'm going to grant. For us, my attorneys and I saying, how could you declare my birth date classified? If a police pulls me aside and says you were speeding, driver's license, please. What am I going to say? I can't hand you my driver's license because it contains my birth date. It is that Kafkaesque. But the fact that these Kafkaesque authoritarian police state requests from the courts sailed through the courts. So you had in federal courts, both at the appellate, later the Supreme Court level, for the judges to agree with it and saying, okay, yes, you can do that. Heck with the First Amendment. Heck with the due process. You can do that. The fact that the Congress can abide by an illegal gag order by the executive branch, well, that happened without any resistance from Senator Grassley, Senator Leahy. There were so many congressional people that they said, okay, if you order us, we'll do it. We're not going to argue with you. That tells you that neither our Bill of Rights nor these notions of checks and balances and the separation of powers really are at work or in practice. And if you were to challenge government's own criminality, whether it's criminal operations or covering up criminal operations, or it's fraud, waste, abuse with consequences borne by the American people, then there is no power above that government. And therefore, our Constitution Bill of Rights is conditional. It will get suspended if you are exposing government wrongdoing, because government is the ultimate power.
Here she's asked if she didn't just violate the gag order.
I'm violating the gag order right and left, especially in the past 6-7 years with my book. We got a special order. It's already on the internet. Justice Department saying that they blacked out because I had to submit my manuscript for my book, Classified Woman. It's a nonfiction. So because of the contract I had signed with the FBI Justice Department, I was obligated to submit that to them. They had 1 month to review it and black out anything that was sensitive or classified. Well, they sat on it for 6 months or so, Tom, and they blacked out everything. They told my attorney every single word in that book is classified. She can't publish it. We are not going to release her from this order. She can't publish it. First of all, I went to publishers and I said, because I know I did not put anything that was justifiably classified, because I know what is classified, what is not. And second, this is against Constitution and First Amendment. The publishers, all these major publishers, they said, unless FBI gave its blessing, they were not going to publish, because then the FBI was going to go after them. So I had to hire my own team, my own editor, my own book cover designer, and the fact checker, and get this book produced and self-publish it via Amazon. And this is after the written letter forbidding me, the government forbidding me from publishing. They didn't do anything. Maybe it was this bluff, who's going to blink first? Maybe the government is so used to federal government by issuing the threat for people just backing off. They thought that was going to be the case. Maybe they thought if they were to take me to court, it was going to bring more publicity for the book and the case and the issue. We are not sure exactly the reason, but I guess they knew with the mainstream media under their control, so there won't be any publicity, any reviews of the book in anything mainstream as far as the media is concerned. It would go away. How many Americans are going to know about FBI whistleblower from 14 years ago or at the time 12 years ago? And maybe they were right. But regardless, I guess standing your ground and saying constitutionally they're wrong, you know, morally they're wrong, and I am not going to back off. And it's my right to publish it, and it's the public's right to read it. And I guess if enough Americans were to do that, whether they are government employees or whether they are just ordinary citizens, we wouldn't be in this position we are today. Unfortunately, that is not the case, because whether with the TSA abuses or with the NSA abuses or with the tortures and black sites, since really most people, they do not dare to stand up or challenge or do anything. We are seeing only the escalations of these police state practices, and things every day is getting worse.
And here she's asked that as an FBI translator, how she had access to all of this information.
Well, not only that my work involved in the FBI with these agents, one of or several important ongoing counterintelligence operations that dated back to 1996. And I performed analysis for them because they didn't have any analysts within the FBI or Justice Department who was both language specialist, knowing the language, plus having the political background of these involved nations or players, which my background did. But also, after the whistleblower journey began for me, the retaliations, polygraph, confiscating my computers, the court cases, I formed my own National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and I have about close to 200 whistleblowers from the FBI and the CIA and the DIA and all these intelligence law enforcement agencies. And also, I have worked with people who later retired from the FBI on some of these issues, not only on my case, but on related cases as well. But also, the political knowledge that comes with my background includes certain operations that were conducted, you know, directed by the United States, but conducted in places where I lived, including Turkey. And again, in many ways, it's different here in the United States. In a way, we are so isolated. When you are in Europe or in Middle East, you get to see many of these operations and policies actually in action. And even though in some of these, you know, all of these third world countries, everybody recognizes them as authoritarian, you know, under dictatorship. I consider, because having the experiences living in those countries, coming from living in those countries, and here for the past 28 years, that the situation of authoritarianism and police state practices is actually much worse here than it is in the worst dictatorship. And here's why. In those countries, there is no doubt in the minds of the public, okay, that they are living under dictatorship. I mean, you talked, 99% of the people would tell you that they are living under authoritarian police states and that they have no rights and no democracy, all that. It's worse here, because here with the illusion, you get most people, the majority, still saying, yeah, things are not perfect, but we are far from being, you know, police state or fascism, etc. And that makes it that much more dangerous here, because there is this denial here. There is, and as long as you have denial, you do not have any possibility, any chance for changing things, for throwing things away and building something new, or any kind of standing up, because there is that denial factor. In those countries, they have better chance, even though they get influenced by outside big countries, than we do here in the United States, because people, they don't want to accept. They are in denial, or they are just honestly naive, like I used to be, saying that, sure, there's some corruption here and there, but we are the best. There is no other country as free as we are. And we do have, and then we celebrate our 4th of July and we eat our hot dogs, we drink beer, we have the firework, and we declare ourselves as a nation of free, where the fact, where the reality is far from it. Thus, rendering us in a more precarious, dangerous situation than those third world countries with already publicly acknowledged authoritarian regimes.
And now here she's asked about how to get people to believe in what she's saying about who's actually sponsoring the terrorists.
They would say it is impossible. Again, it comes, again, thanks to the mainstream media, maybe resistance by the people to actually even delve into history and context. That is not something new. Operation Gladio began right after World War II, and it is not a conspiracy theory. If you were to go and type it, it was a NATO, US, and UK-ran operation that said, okay, in order to counter the communism and Soviet Union, okay, and what we're going to do is we're going to create these false flag terror events in Turkey. And if you go to the list, these are confirmed lists. CIA's FOIA, after 40 years, have already put this information out. You will see these terror incidents in Italy, okay, that was conducted by the U.S. NATO forces, and then that was blamed on some communist faction in Italy or the Soviet Union. You go and look at Bulgaria and you see what happened there. You will go and see in Turkey. So these false flag operations, they're already confirmed. So what happened, Tom, is after the fall of the Soviet Union, that operation started shifting starting in 1995. And that's the counterintelligence operations I was working with the FBI agents in this specific, very contained unit within FBI's Washington field office. Around 1995, 1996, the original Operation Gladio, which I refer to Gladio A, shifted to Gladio B. Now, instead of having creating these false synthetic terror events for the long-term objectives of the powers, the Western powers, and blaming it on the communism with the Soviet Union gone, it was going to be blamed on the Islamists. And that was going to pave the way, not only our way into the Middle East, but mostly, and this is again something nobody wants to pay attention or even know about here in this country, with the main targets being Central Asia and Caucasus. Saudi Arabia oil is not going to be here in another 10, 15 years. The long-term objective has been Eurasia. It's been all these natural gas-rich, mineral-rich, oil-rich nations surrounding Russia. Whether you're looking at Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan or Azerbaijan. So, for example, let me give you a quick example to you. In 1997, because my counterintelligence unit also involved a lot of operatives and people from Turkey, Turkish being my primary main language, there was this mullah, this imam, this extremist Islamist guy named Fethullah Gulen, okay? Fethullah Gulen was preaching and wanting to bring Sharia law, and Turkey, even though they had elections, they were still, and they are still, under the military regime since the coup in 1981. So they decided to jail this guy. Mysteriously, Fethullah Gulen got into a Gulfstream jet, CIA-owned, in 1997, and he was brought into Washington, D.C., okay? And worked with the State Department and worked with the State Department's other puppet. And this is the guy they declared the United States State Department, the president in absentia of Turkestan, which is the Xinjiang region in China. So basically they said, this guy is a president. He's the Washington DC, but because the objectives also include Xinjiang area. And this is again, Turkic faction living in that portion of China, which sits on this very important pipeline for gas and oil. And by 1998, this man, this Imam Mullah from Turkey, Fethullah Gulen, began his NGO organization under moderate Islam here in Washington, D.C. and in Pennsylvania, okay? And right now, if he's still here, okay, if you go and put Fethullah Gulen NGO organization, it will give you the value of this organization in terms of financial power at $22+ billion. He owns the largest charter school groups in the United States. Well, our operatives from the CIA and State Department, under his name, with him, they began establishing more than 350 mosques in places like Azerbaijan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Now, nobody knows where this guy is bringing his $22 billion. Nobody knows about the source of this, which goes to the heroin operation that is conducted by U.S. NATO via their proxy nation, Turkey, through Turkey. Now, those labs to process those poppies moved from Turkey to Azerbaijan. Currently, a lot of those labs are in Azerbaijan, and now they are able to do it in the source, which is Afghanistan, but they couldn't do that 15, 18 years ago. Fethullah Gulen is not a conspiracy theory. People can go. He's a Turkish mullah. He is worth $22 billion. He's the man. If they go and look at the number of mosques, by now it's about 380 plus mosques that we, together with Fethullah Gulen, we, the United States State Department and CIA, have established all over the Central Asia and Caucasus. Some of these mosques, their grounds were used for training Chechens, okay? And getting these Chechen fighters in mid-1990s into Balkan during our Balkan Wars. Some of these Chechen we used to send them into Russia to execute terror attacks. Well, some of these same Chechens now with ISIL, those same Chechens are being sent, have been sent into Syria and in Iraq. If you go and look at the roots of the Chechen terrorism, well, we did it with this mullah. We have been doing it, Mullah Fethullah Gulen, in all this region starting in mid-1990s under Operation Gladio B. And it, the documentation in terms of what this man has been doing, he's like an 82 years old man. He only went through third grade education. He's has semi-Alzheimer, okay? He's sitting in this castle in Pennsylvania. It's a major castle, and the compound is protected by all these mercenaries and with helicopter security. And this man owns and operates the largest charter school chain in the United States of America. And he is, as far as the reach is concerned in terms of building mosques and training terrorist grounds, this man is much bigger than entire operations conducted by Saudi Arabia under our guidance. But nobody will talk about that in the U.S. mainstream media, even though the facts for it is out there for everyone to see.
And again, you were just listening to FBI translator and whistleblower Sybelle Edmonds. From an April 2016 interview on the Tom Woods radio show, she has written two books, Classified Woman and Lone Gladio. Her website is boilingfrogspost.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Our guest today is Stephen Lenman, and he is the editor of an important new book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Oh, thank you, Phil. Good to be on with you.
I have to say that this is the old cliche that your book is sort of torn from today's headlines. The headline in The Guardian reads, Ukraine clashes have leave several dead and test Trump's Russian stance. And as well, in today's Globe and Mail, our national paper, the editors are advising that more soldiers, Canadian, be sent to Ukraine as a way to help. And I don't know. Tell your book, Flashpoint Ukraine, would argue that both these headlines and the themes are somewhat off point. Tell us where this problem comes from. Why? How are we in a situation where people are talking about sending more Canadian troops because of some little violence in Ukraine today?
Well, the violence was instigated by the government against people in the southeast of the country, Phil, what I call the Donbass area of Ukraine, and the people who are resisting the tyranny in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. I call them freedom fighters because that's exactly what they are. They refuse to live under a fascist dictatorship, which was what Washington installed in Ukraine. This is what the Obama administration did in February 2014. The legitimate government, which was far from perfect, it was pretty abysmal, as a matter of fact, under President Yanukovych, second time he'd been president. There was a revolution. There was an orange revolution against him, I believe, in 2004. And his replacement, I forget the president's name, who took his place, installed by Washington, by the Bush people. A name very similar to Yanukovych, but not quite the same. But he was Washington's man in Kiev, and conditions were so abysmal in the country that there was an election in 2010, and Yanukovych won the election to come back into power. He should have used his office more responsibly than he did. He was a setup to really let America come back in again and instigate a coup against him, which is what happened. It began in late 2013, culminating in February 2014, where under the direction of Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, a neocon in the Obama administration.
Yes. By the way, just to come in here, the writers take up this role, and people really need to be reminded how overtly the Americans involved themselves. They were glad to be seen, Senator McCain, and also the liberal Democrat from Massachusetts. But Victoria Nuland, she set some sort of record for butting into a country's business, didn't she?
Oh, she really did, and she has a notorious record. She was a member of she was an aide to Dick Cheney way back in the Bush administration. And I mean, her resume, I wrote about it. It's been a good while. I'd have to go back and look at it to see all of the dark spots on it. But just an abysmal record. And yet, Hillary Clinton picked her. Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, picked her. And heaven knows if Hillary had won, maybe Victoria Nuland would have become Secretary of State. Oh, my God, absolutely an abomination. The Ukrainian person I couldn't think of, his name was Yushchenko, Yanukovych Yushchenko. They almost sounded alike. He was Washington's man. They put him in, and now they've got this guy, Poroshenko.
The chocolate king.
Petro Poroshenko, the so-called chocolate king, a billionaire. Well, I guess a billionaire. Well, that could be. It certainly isn't an attribute, and in his case, it's absolutely a detriment. And he went to war. The coup installed. They staged an election after the coup, and he basically was an appointed president by Washington, an illegitimate government, a putschist government. It's illegitimate, absolutely Nazi infested, and that's no exaggeration, with extremist elements infesting the government, infesting the country, committing grievous human rights abuses against Ukrainian people. And the economic agenda is right out of the playbook of the IMF, inflicting enormous harm on the Ukrainian people, deep poverty, you know, job unemployment, and the rest of it. Just a horrible situation. I mean, it's being set up for another coup to get somebody else in and get these people out. But what Trump should responsibly do is not support these people. He's got to know. He's got to be briefed. I mean, if I know that a putschist government is running Ukraine and he's the president and he doesn't know this, then he's got no right being president.
So yes.
He's got to know it. But I was very disturbed by a comment by his new UN envoy, Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina. She's very new in the job, just a few days into it. Mm-hmm. And she made a comment that the Trump administration respects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. I mean, that sounds to me like an endorsement of the fascist regime, and that bothers me a great deal.
It's very worrying. And by the way, again, I'll just tell our listeners, this book is Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. And as you're outlining, if the rhetoric from Washington follows along the lines of that new ambassador, the risk of war is very great. I suppose we have to point out that watching Trump, the major thing with him that has seemed to have got everybody steamed, particularly the Democrats, is that he said, I would like to have a different relationship with Russia. But this book actually underlines that would be changing a policy that is, I think you say, goes back at least almost 100 years. Could you talk about how hard it would be to turn that war machine around?
Oh, it would be so very, very hard, Phil. U.S. adversarial relations toward Russia goes back to the 1917 revolution, when the Tsar was overthrown and the Bolsheviks took over the country. And most people don't even know that back in the days of Woodrow Wilson as America's president, he sent U.S. Marines into Russia, coming into the northern part of Russia in an attempt to overthrow the government and install a government that Washington would support. The attempt failed, and I forget how long the Marines stayed there. Mm-hmm. It might have been so many thousands of Marines, not a massive force, but maybe 6,000-8,000 Marines came in, mm-hmm. and it didn't get the job done. I mean, the new government survived. They had their own difficulties with one group of elements battling with the other, and the Bolsheviks finally won. But
Churchill said they should have strangled Bolshevism in its cradle.
I think something like that, exactly, Phil.
What a warm thought.
Lenin wasn't the bad guy. Stalin was the bad guy. when Stalin came into power and Lenin passed from the scene, that's when things really got nasty. But Russia didn't attack anybody. I mean, they certainly controlled what they called the near abroad, because there was the Russian Empire with all these countries that are now independent surrounding Russia to the west of Russia. All these countries are independent now, mm-hmm. including in World War II, Russia took half of Poland. Hitler took the other half. But the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, they were Russian. They were Russian provinces, and now they're independent. And others too. Some of the countries we call the Stans countries. Some of them, Tajikistan and Kajikistan. I got to have the names in front of me to pronounce
list of
them correctly.
Yes.
Yeah, some of them are independent, but some of them are part of the Western sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. And this was just devastating. I think Russians look back at that period of time where Gorbachev cut a deal with George H.W. Bush.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, because that is another striking feature of how this unfolded. The Gorbachev story, which he tells himself, that they had the meetings – and they began to dismantle what was called the Soviet Union. And he had the assurance of Reagan and of James Baker, Secretary of State, I think. And one of the blessings of this was there was going to – remember the word peace dividend? And there wasn't going to be a NATO expansion toward Russia. Under Clinton more than – Reagan, they began to expand toward the east. But one of your authors points out in this book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, edited by Stephen Lundman, that unfortunately, and this is really kind of almost a mystery to me, they never got this in writing. There was no treaty.
And it should have been.
I mean, Gorbachev, I hate to say it, but seems to have almost invited them to walk right over him.
He got snookered. He really did.
Snookered is a good expression.
Yeah, I think they shouldn't have trusted. He shouldn't have trusted. Nobody in Russia should have trusted America then, even though it's so much worse now.
By the way, it's supposed to be a country that suspects is reading Professor McMurtry, who is, by the way, from Guelph. He says that they always call the Russians paranoid and suspicious. Well, that wasn't exactly a paranoid and suspicious bit of behavior. He actually made a friendship agreement with the United States, didn't get it in writing.
That's right. And I think he looks back at that period of time and realizes he made a terrible mistake. I just wrote about him saying the world is heading toward World War III. He's well up in years now. He's 86 years old. He was a much younger man back then. But he cut a deal in good faith, and America betrayed him. He should have realized that going back to the 1917 revolution, America betrayed Russia over and over again. You simply cannot trust America. It makes deals and then breaches them. So the other side keeps its word, and America doesn't. And I quoted Sergei Lavrov after Trump came into office, saying Russia is under no illusion that everything is going to go smoothly and we'll have rapprochement with America. I mean, he was very pointed in his comment, and I think that's very much the case with Lavrov, the foreign minister, mm-hmm. and Vladimir Putin. I mean, they'll do what they can in normalizing relations with America, knowing full well that whatever is agreed on could just come crumbling apart. And, of course, there'll be another president one day after Trump, whenever that is, mm-hmm. and whatever Trump institutes, even if they could does good things, everything could come apart after that. You simply can't trust America. It's been an imperialist throughout its entire history since George Washington. If the country didn't expand from sea to shining sea by being good guys, I mean, they massacred the entire native population,
yes.
almost 98% of them, something like that.
Yeah, and, by the way, again, one of your authors quotes George Kennan, who is called the father of the containment policy.
Yes.
Containing something that didn't need containing. But I was struck by the quotes, and again, I really recommend people get this book, but where Kennan is very cold-blooded. He says, we're not going to do this because we're nice. We should even forget about being nice, and this is not about democracy. This is about containing.
Yes, that was my chapter, by the way.
Yeah, but, oh, well, I'm happy to quote you then. This is, we're speaking to Stephen Lenman. Right? I don't want to.
He was a dove, Phil.
You're going to make sure I get the right author this time.
I had a few chapters in the book myself. That was one of them.
Well, before we go back to Kenan, let me just tell our listeners, too, that you can go to sjlenman.blogspot.ca for daily, very helpful assessments of crises around the world. And that's sjlenman.blogspot.com.
Or a simpler way to go is simply to Google Steve Lenman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, which is the way I access it. And anybody can – I put new articles up every day.
We're in this new age where I'm still – you know, I'm quoting things in the New York Times trying to get the page number. and you're quite right. All you have to do is just put the guy's name in, never mind the first name, and you get it. But it's Stephen Lenman. And you did make the point and Kenan was absolutely cold-blooded. And that is, it seems to me, that is the profile you want to understand about policymakers in Washington.
Yeah, that's very true. And again, I would emphasize that he was very dovish compared to most of the people around today. And he was very cold-blooded. And he wrote his ideas at a time that America was supremely dominant after World War II, where at least it had no competition. I mean, there's no such thing as a trade deficit. It was America made everything and exported it to other countries, and now it's completely the reverse of it. But he argued that, to maintain U.S. supremacy, it can't be a good guy. It has to be very cold-blooded about the way it does things. And this George Kennan, I mean, you can imagine the way people operate today.
And again, the book is Flashpoint Ukraine. I want to keep reminding everybody, edited by Stephen Lenman. As he said, by the way, just Google it and get yourself a copy. Let's go back. Just the two questions that, and the book treats them both very in great detail, so people would really benefit. The coup that occurred, that was so nakedly clear and to be a coup, and yet no one uses the term coup to describe what happened in February 2014, and that was a negotiated agreement. The president met with the opposition. The dignitaries from the EU were present, and they signed a reasonable way to solve the violence and sort of social tumult going on in the country, egged on by Ms. Newman. But it was a coup, wasn't it? I mean, why wouldn't we, and if we're going to solve this present crisis, wouldn't we have to go back and say, you haven't had an agreement, just observe it, and you could probably have a peaceful country?
Well, if I was the president of the United States, I would point blank explain what happened in Ukraine. I might not last long doing the things that I would do, Phil, but I would explain there was a coup and the government there is illegitimate, and the United States will no longer recognize it, let alone provide it military aid and all the rest, which is what Obama was doing after the coup. But the coup was instigated, the legitimate government was overthrown, and the putschist government was put in its place. And it really is a wretched government. It's at war with its own people in Donbass, the Donbass region in the southeast of the country. And it just revved up again about 4 or 5 days ago. And in the past couple of days, I wrote a couple of articles.
Killing their own people, as Obama would like to.
Killing their own people, absolutely. And they're blamed. They're blamed, and Russia is blamed for what's going on. I wrote an article today that I got out on it. It's on my blog site. People can read it. Where the Washington Post, I just very briefly at the end, I mentioned the Washington Post editorial. They blame Russian black, whatever they call them.
Yes, pro-Russians.
Shelling the Ukrainian forces. The Ukrainian forces are shelling the Donbass people, killing civilians, inflicting damage, and the Donbass freedom fighters are responding in self-defense, which is exactly what they have to do. And, of course, they're supported by international law, but not according to the Washington Post. The victim is the aggressor, and the aggressor is the victim, and that's the way things are portrayed in the U.S.
and that
media.
Sure, they were protected by that agreement, which has been violated by the people who made the coup. They really don't have any reason to follow any of its dictates because it's not a legitimate government.
Well, that's right. The people in Donbass absolutely reject the government of Kiev. They want nothing to do with it. They want their own autonomy. They want to be part of Ukraine. They don't want to leave and be a separate entity. I think what they ideally love is to be part of Russia. And it's a shame that Putin, when the Crimean situation came about, and Russia did not annex Crimea, the Crimea joined Russia, and Putin simply acknowledged it and went along with it. But something like 96% of Crimeans in a national referendum, judged open, free, and fair by international observers, voted to rejoin Russia to correct a historic mistake. At the same time, Putin should have helped the people of Donbass and let them join Russia at the same time. Then all this fuss never would have happened. The war wouldn't have happened. The killing wouldn't have happened. None of this would be going on, because to attack Donbass would be attacking Russia, and the lunatics in Kiev wouldn't dare do that.
Mm-hmm. On that matter of Crimea, which is so important, and by the way, there's a great essay in your book by Professor Chalcedowski, which people, Canadians, know him, the Global Research, wonderful website, points out that on the Crimea matter, if I get this, now I've lost track of my point, but it's really Russia's deciding to be clear on its borders and on its prerogatives as a state that has saved everybody in this situation, not accepting the kind of this new world order idea that there is one power that makes a determination.
Absolutely, and Crimea is very strategically important for America to control Crimea, and Russia has its naval fleet based in Sevastopol, and with a long-term agreement with Ukraine. And of course, Ukraine was part of Russia until 1991, when the dissolution took place, and Crimea was ceded to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev, a terrible mistake, whole thing a mistake, and that was just one of them. But it would just be devastating for Russia to have America.
And the people weren't consulted in that instance. They weren't given a chance for a referendum.
Oh, that's right. It simply happened. The deal was cut. And the point that you made very, very accurately, that Gorbachev has promised that NATO would not expand east, and boy, did it ever expand east, beginning with the Clintons, and then very much so with Bush and Obama.
Mm-hmm. Apropos of Obama, one of his great flubs, and he's a rather smooth operator, but I was struck by the fact that when he was trying to make the Crimea the kind of a near war kind of issue, he was reminded by many states and individuals that in Kosovo, the U.S. took part of Serbia away from it, and someone said, and there, you know, there was a referendum in Crimea. He said, well, there was also a referendum in Kosovo. He actually made that flub. I watched him do it. I was very struck. There was no referendum in Kosovo.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This was all arranged by America, and it's amazing the way they reinvent history, Phil. And the media repeats it like it's absolute fact. So when Trump refers to the media putting out fake news, that's exactly right. I mean, just a proliferation of fake news. Mm-hmm. He's got a couple of favorites that he likes to go after. Some of them are mine. He's very, 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 very. Very indignant about what the New York Times and Washington Post writes about him, and also CNN. But he really should go after them all. The only one that has given him a fair shake has been Fox News.
Yeah, I want to mention too, by the way, an outstanding essay in this book is by Edward Herman and David Peterson. They go into this matter of just how this thing of fake news. I mean, American media lives and breathes fake news. I mean, for example, the Kosovo story, nobody who has returned us to the point and reminded us that there's a major military, U.S. military base now, is there not, in Kosovo?
Yes, yes, indeed. I believe the biggest one in Europe.
I mean, that's sort of, that ought to be kind of giving off light or something for all of us to be reminded. That's a major move by a superpower to build a base in a country that Well, it's declared it a country. It never actually has had any referendum, and certainly Serbia did not has never actually conceded that that is legal.
Oh, it's not legal. And throughout the 1990s, we had the Balkan Wars, which I refer to the Clintons as the Clinton co-presidency, Phil, because Hillary was very much involved in the decision-making with her husband, even though his name was on all the stuff that went out. But the two of them together were partners, and he made a big point about saying, when you elect one, you get two for the price of one. And that's exactly the way it was, but not for something good, for something pure evil. But the Balkan Wars went on throughout the 1990s. To get rid of, to break up Yugoslavia. And Russia was very, very concerned about that. It didn't do anything about it, but it went on. And the country was, in my words, raped, absolutely raped, culminating with the 1999 rape of Serbia, Kosovo, and the separation of the two. Just absolutely terrible. And yet these people like Clinton and Obama leave office with a high approval rating, showing the American people know nothing about what's going on.
Yeah. Just to wind up, let me ask you to expand or to discuss this thesis of Professor McMurtry. He says that if you follow the U.S. IMF sort of strategy of regime change and what they bring, he says they bring nothing but rape and destruction, that they don't build things. They hollow countries out when they come in. That's a very sobering and a very persuasive argument. He said, please make a list and see if you can find any contradiction to that. He talks about all the places where they go with the color revolutions and whatnot. He says they hollow the country out.
That's exactly right. I've used the expression, wherever America shows up, mass slaughter and destruction follow. That's exactly right. You could look at one country after another. When World War II ended, Phil, it looked like we finally would have an era of peace, but it wasn't to be because Truman went to war with North Korea, and the North didn't attack the South. The South attacked the North.
You cite I.F. Stone. Thank you very much.
I.F. Stone, absolutely. Hidden history of the Korean War. I have a copy of his book, a personalized, signed by him. I bought it used, and it's a treasure. I bought it for $10, Phil. I wouldn't sell it for $200.
We should put that book back in circulation. You and I should start a movement to get I.F. Stone. That book, as you point out in this book, Flashpoint Ukraine, is essential to understand what happened after World War II.
It really is. I think if you read any of these books, whether the Ukraine book, the Stone books, they don't not only tell you about the material they talk about, but they tell you, they explain U.S. foreign policy, and that's what's key to understand. Imperial policy based on permanent wars against countries threatening no one. This is what America's agenda is. America hasn't had an enemy since Japan surrendered in August 1945, and yet America's been waging continued wars against one country after another, from Harry Truman, and heaven knows what Trump is going to do, but he sent a commando group into Yemen. He's using drone bombing, so it looks like, at least to some extent, he's continuing the same thing, which if that's the case, it's very, very disappointing.
Yeah, we have a new cowboy in the saddle.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, Stephen Lenman, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. I assume they could just Google that title and they could order that book. Thank you very, very much for being our guest.
Oh, thank you, Phil.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I'm not going to talk about the travel ban. I'm just going to talk about the very non-political, family-friendly, People's Choice Award-winning Finding Dory.
Peace and blessings be upon you.
If you're gay, lesbian, or bisexual, you're 3 to 4 times more at risk for attempting suicide. On an average day, we might get about 130 to 140 calls, which is really a lot.
That is a lot.
And in the 2 days following the election, we had almost 700.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The Boy Scouts of America transitions on gender identity, screen actors mix politics with prizes, and Trump's teens turn to the Trevor Project. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 4th, 2017. After more than a century of entrenched resistance, the Boy Scouts of America completed its total evolution on LGBT people this week by announcing that it will welcome transgender kids who identify as boys into its ranks, as well as transgender adult leaders. The youth organization opened its doors to openly gay scouts in 2013 and to out gay adult leaders and employees in 2015. The BSA announcement said that it would immediately begin accepting the gender identity specified by a child or parent on its enrollment applications. Admittance had previously been based only on the child's birth certificate. The group acknowledged the highly publicized case of Joe Maldonado, an 8-year-old Secaucus, New Jersey boy who was told to leave his scout troop late last year after some parents found out he's transgender and complained. But the BSA statement said the decision was made in the context of the larger discussion of trans issues going on around the country. Joe has been invited to rejoin his troop. Christy Maldonado, Joe's mom, said they'd like that, but only after the scout leader who kicked Joe out leaves.
Sweden's National Board of Health and Welfare announced this week that transgender people will no longer be classified as mentally ill. The board's leader, Christina Brand Persson, called it a completely reasonable change because it follows the October 2016 World Health Organization decision to do the same. Several Swedish trans activists ridiculed the announcement on Twitter as long overdue. "Wake me," one wrote. "Is it 2017 or 1817? Sweden has tended to lag behind many of its regional neighbors in its treatment of transgender citizens. Until its repeal in 2013, a Swedish law made sterilization a requirement, or, as the statute described it, lack of the ability to procreate, before the government would legally recognize a trans person's gender.
Switzerland has lifted its lifetime ban on blood donations by men who have sex with men. However, like a similar announcement a few weeks ago in the Republic of Ireland, gay and bisexual men who want to help save lives will still have to have been celibate for the past year. Activists applauded the step forward,
but echoed those in other countries with similar restrictions, who argue that potential blood donors should be screened on the basis of personal behavior and not sexual orientation.
Elsewhere, another judge in Lebanon has questioned the country's laws banning private consensual adult same-gender lovemaking. Judge Rabi Maalouf ruled in a court near Beirut this week that because homosexuality is a natural variant, Lebanese Penal Code Article 534, outlawing intercourse contrary to the order of nature, doesn't apply. Homosexuality is a personal choice, he wrote, not a criminal offense. The law currently punishes same-gender sex with up to a year in prison. The judge referenced Article 183 of the Penal Code, which states that an act undertaken in exercise of a right without abuse shall not be regarded as an offense. In other words, if no harm is done, there is no crime. Human Rights Watch notes that Maalouf is just the latest magistrate to question the interpretation of Article 534. Judges did the same in cases involving private consensual adult gay sex in 2007 and 2014. The Lebanese Psychiatric Society issued a statement in 2013 affirming that homosexuality is not a mental disorder, and in 2015, the organization specifically called for the abolition of Article 534.
An appeals court in the Estonian capital of Tallinn ordered the country this week to recognize a gay couple who'd been legally married in Sweden. A lower court rejected the Estonian men's request to have their marriage entered into the civil register. Appeals court judges ruled in their favor in December. After time expired for authorities to file an appeal, the couple finally entered their marriage in the civil register on January 31st. Equality activists are hoping it's just the first step toward full civil marriage equality in their country. Queer couples have been able to enter into civil partnerships in Estonia since last year, which made it the first former Soviet republic to legally recognize same-gender couples. And even though civil partnerships were supposed to provide gay and lesbian couples with almost the same rights as heterosexual couples, they're denied adoptions equality, for example. Critics charge that almost the same is not equal.
Norway's Evangelical Lutheran Church adopted a new liturgy this week that will allow ministers to bless the marriages of same-gender couples. Church officials approved the move last year, but a special liturgy had to be developed before gay and lesbian couples could enjoy church weddings. The General Synod voted 83-29 on January 30th to approve the new service, which essentially replaces bride and groom in the wedding ceremony with gender-neutral terms. The liturgy to bless heterosexual couples remains unchanged. Individual pastors are free to decide whether or not to officiate at the weddings of same-gender couples. At last count, about 73% of Norway's 5.2 million residents are registered members of the church, which officially separated from the state on January 1st. Civil marriage and adoption have been open to same-gender couples in Norway since 2009. The church also ordains openly gay ministers.
Thousands of British gay and bisexual men were officially pardoned this week, albeit posthumously, for criminal convictions that would not be against the law today. Private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex was decriminalized in Britain in 1967. Turing's Law, as it's called, is named for Alan Turing. He was the brilliant World War II forefather of the modern computer who cracked the Nazi Enigma code. He committed suicide in 1954 following his forced chemical castration after being convicted of engaging in private, consensual, adult gay sex. Turing received a royal pardon in 2013. His relatives pushed for the passage of Turing's Law to expunge the records of those similarly convicted. The law received official royal assent on January 31st. "We can never undo the hurt caused," said Justice Minister Sam Gyimah, "but we have apologized and taken action to right these wrongs." Irish-born playwright Oscar Wilde was among some 50,000 gay men given posthumous pardons in the UK. Those convicted under the so-called buggery laws before 1967 and are still living can apply to the Home Office to have their convictions expunged.
The government of the Republic of Ireland has agreed not to oppose a bill that will similarly pardon an estimated 2,000 men who were convicted of violating Irish laws against gay sex. Those laws were only abolished in Ireland in 1993.
In this week's Trump News, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer followed up his "I don't know" in response to a question at a briefing last week to say in a statement this week that President Trump intends to maintain the anti-bias protections for LGBT federal workers that were implemented under former President Barack Obama. The New York Times reported that Trump's daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner, an official presidential advisor, were instrumental in convincing Trump to keep the protections.
But rumors have swirled around Trump's reported support of the First Amendment Defense Act, a bill percolating in Congress that would allow individuals and businesses to overtly discriminate against LGBT people based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. Press Secretary Spicer said this week that the White House has no plans to issue a similar so-called religious freedom executive order at this time.
And finally, queer advocacy groups have joined a chorus of progressive organizations expressing concerns about President Trump's nomination of Boulder, Colorado-based federal appeals court judge Neil Gorsuch to fill the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court left by the death almost a year ago of far-right Justice Antonin Scalia. Gorsuch is said to be a keen admirer of the arch-conservative ideologue, who was a vocal opponent of every LGBT rights case that came before him during his long tenure on the High Court. As a judge on the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, Gorsuch's ruling in the Hobby Lobby case supported the right of a conservative Christian-run company to withhold contraception services from the healthcare benefits it offers its employees. Equality California Executive Director Rick Zabur warned in a statement that such a ruling bodes ill for LGBT people who are facing an onslaught of laws sanctioning discrimination in the name of religious liberty. Meanwhile, the High Court announced this week that the justices would hear oral arguments in the case of Virginia transgender high school student Gavin Grimm on March 28th. He sued the Gloucester County School Board last year, demanding the right to use restrooms on campus consistent with his gender identity. It will be the first time the U.S. Supreme Court has heard a case involving the rights of transgender people.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 4th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
Teen trauma gets tougher in the time of Trump. Later in the program.
I'm Diddly Day, an actor's life is gay. It's great to be a celebrity, an actor's life for me.
A perhaps more queer than usual annual Screen Actors Guild Awards ceremony was held in Los Angeles on January 29th. Lesbian icon Lily Tomlin accepted SAG's Lifetime Achievement Award with her trademark biting humor, and numerous other LGBTQ fan favorites took home trophies. President Trump's immigration travel ban was barely 48 hours old when it prompted comments by several winners. The multinational, partly queer cast of Orange is the New Black accepted the award for Best Ensemble TV Comedy. Taylor Piper Schilling got a little help from her friends during the acceptance speech.
We stand up here representing a diverse group of people, representing generations of families who have sought a better life here from places like Nigeria, the Dominican Republic,
Puerto Rico,
Colombia,
Colombia, hey. Ireland,
Brooklyn,
yes. And we know that it's going to be up to us and all of you probably too to keep telling stories that show what unites us is stronger than the forces that seek to divide us.
Yeah. At some point, you got to decide for yourself who you're going to be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
Moonlight's Mahershala Ali gave heartfelt thanks for his win for outstanding film performance by a male actor in a supporting role. He played a drug dealer named Juan who takes a bullied gay youth under his wing.
What I've learned from working on Moonlight is we see what happens when you persecute people. They fold into themselves And what I was so grateful about in having the opportunity to play Juan was playing a gentleman who saw a young man folding into himself as a result of the persecution of his community, and taking that opportunity to uplift him and tell him that he mattered, that he was okay, and accept him. And I hope that we do a better job of that. You know, when we kind of get caught up in the minutiae, the details that make us all different, I think there's two ways of seeing that. There's an opportunity to see the texture of that person, the characteristics that make them unique. And then there's an opportunity to go to war about it and to say that that person is different from me and I don't like you, so let's battle. My mother is an ordained minister. I'm a Muslim. She didn't do backflips when I called her to tell her I converted 17 years ago. But I tell you now, we put things to the side, and I'm able to see her. She's able to see me. We love each other. The love has grown, and that stuff is minutia. It's not that important. So, thank you. Peace and blessings be upon you.
Even daytime talk show queen Ellen DeGeneres had words about the Trump travel ban this week.
Heard, this is what happened. Over the weekend, on Friday, the president gave an order banning people from seven countries from entering the United States, including people with green cards. And then on Saturday, the president screened Finding Dory at the White House. I'm not going to talk about the travel ban. I'm just going to talk about the very non-political, family-friendly, People's Choice Award-winning Finding Dory. Of course, Finding Dory is about a fish named Dory, and Dory lives in Australia, and these are her parents, and they live in America, and I don't know what religion they are, but her dad sounds a little Jewish. Doesn't matter. Dory arrives in America with her friends Marlin and Nemo, and she ends up at the Marine Life Institute behind a large wall, and they all have to get over the wall. And you won't believe it, but that wall has almost no effect in keeping them out. Even though Dory gets into America, she ends up separated from her family. But the other animals help Dory, animals that don't even need her, animals that don't even have anything in common with her. They help her even though they're completely different colors, because that's what you do when you see someone in need. You help them. So that is what I hope everyone who's watching Finding Dory has learned. Tune in next week when I explain women's rights, talking about the movie Mr. Wrong.
Oops.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson, Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Careful the things you say, children will listen. Careful the things you do, children will see.
The Trump effect on minority youth is part of the collateral damage following the U.S. presidential election. This Way Out's Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones discuss the latest threat to already threatened LGBTQ young people in particular, and a lot more, with Abby Land, executive director of the literally life-saving Trevor Project.
We work to prevent suicide for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth up to 25. One thing many people don't know is suicide is actually the second leading cause of death of all young people 10 to 24. But if you're gay, lesbian, or bisexual, you're 3 to 4 times more at risk for attempting suicide, and almost half of trans youth have thought about suicide. We have been around since 1998, and over those years have helped thousands upon thousands of youth who've reached out to us in often their darkest moment. And we do our services through a 24/7 lifeline that young people can call us from all across the country, as well as we have Trevor Chat and we have Trevor Text.
And what is Trevor Text?
Young people can text us when they're in crisis.
And there's a live person to text right back?
We have our counselors are available 24/7.
Any way that you can connect with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, part of what we really try to do is make sure we meet youth where they are. And so though many, many youth actually reach out to us using the telephone, more and more youth obviously are, you know, on the computer. So we chat with them, instant messaging. And then so many more are texting each other. You wouldn't think you would text about this, but many youth do text about it. So we have counselors that we've trained to be there for the young people.
Huffington Post reported that you guys are getting a real flood of calls since the election.
Sit down. You weren't called. Sit down.
No,
sit down.
I have the right to ask a question.
No, you don't. Go back to Univision.
Is there a Muslim problem? Absolutely, yes. I didn't see Swedish people knocking down the World Trade Center.
How do you define Black Lives Matter?
Well, I would say they're dividing America.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, coming out of her wherever.
Rosie O'Donnell's disgusting, both inside and out. You take a look at her, she's a slob. She talks like a truck driver.
On an average day, if you would, between our chat, text, and lifeline, we might get about 130 to 140 calls, which is really a lot.
That is a lot.
And in the 2 days following the election, we had almost 700 calls.
What was the nature of the calls?
What we heard over and over again from the young folks that were reaching out to us was they're scared. There's this big question. What does it mean? You know, they listened for months to this political rhetoric. People were being told they were less than and not equal to. And now these people, our president and our vice president, people called afraid to lose their rights, afraid of losing health care, of maybe having to go to conversion therapy. So there's a lot of fear there. We remind them that over half of the voters actually voted a different way. In fact, the popular vote was much more for the other candidate. And we remind them that they're special the way they are, and there's a whole lot of people out there fighting for them. And that, I think, is a really important message. At the Trevor Project in the days following the election, we had so many notes and cards, you know, from people reaching out to us from really all over the world, from 20 different countries. We got notes and support saying, we know the work you're doing is really important right now, and we want to make sure that you can be there for the young people. So we share that with them. We let them know they're not alone, that there's a lot of us there that are going to be there for them.
Something that surprised me about the Trevor Project that I learned a while ago is that while your mission is crisis intervention and suicide prevention, you will take calls really from anybody with serious issues to discuss, family members who are trying to understand.
We are a fully accredited lifeline. We meet all the national standards. The bulk of our calls are on young people who are in crisis up to 25. But obviously, we talk to anyone. And we do get a number of parents who call. And certainly, even since this election, a number of parents have called trying to understand what to even say to their children, you know, trying to understand that. And we have a lot of information on our website. And we encourage people to reach out, to call us. And, you know, sometimes just talking through some of those issues makes a difference. But for young people who are specifically 13 to 24, we have something called Trevor Space. And Trevor Space, it's a Facebook-like community of LGBTQ, AIP, young people. And it's really a community where you can go and suddenly you realize you're not alone, you know, because even sometimes when you're in the middle of Los Angeles, you think you're the only one, let alone when you might be in a very small town where literally you might not know anyone. So here you come onto Trevor Space. We have over 150,000 young people on Trevor Space. And it is that place where you could talk, ask questions. And so you're not in crisis, but, you know, it's like, I want to tell my mom I'm gay and I don't know what to do. And, you know, boy, you'll get a whole lot of folks telling you, do this, don't do that. And so it's a really wonderful place because we know that It's really important to feel like you're part of a community.
And you sort of police that site?
We have volunteers who monitor that site. It's a safe site that we ensure that it's safety. We make sure, too, if someone is really in crisis, that we can reach out to them so that they can talk to folks on our counseling line.
Abby Land is the executive director of the Trevor Project. I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
One of the issues that I know can be the most challenging for a queer youth, queer anybody, is religion, family religion. And I'm wondering how you navigate that.
Part of what we do, we're there to listen. We're not there to pass judgment. And, you know, religion is a really important thing in many people's lives. And just because you might be going to a church or temple or something where they're telling you something different, that's still your community. So, you know, we're there to listen and help figure out how to navigate that or find a place that might be more accepting and welcoming. Because really, a religion is a big protective factor for so many of us. And especially in certain communities, you know, here in LA, we'll say, hey, what do you do for a living? In the South, it's office. What church do you go to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we do work to help the youth figure out how to find their place.
Looking ahead, I don't know if the election has changed any of your sort of goals or strategies for the future, but is there anything that comes to mind, like where you feel like you need to go next?
You know, that's a really good question. I think so many of us are trying to figure out what the impact of the election is. We're a nonprofit, so we're nonpartisan. The issue of suicide crosses party lines,
yeah.
And nobody wants to see a young person lose their life. So we have to kind of figure out how to maneuver. But I know that over the next few months, we have to look at how we can keep getting the message out about the Trevor Project so they know that they can call the Trevor Project. And we do advocacy work. In California, we passed legislation that mandates that middle and high school districts have suicide prevention policies that specifically call out those youth most at risk, including LGBTQ youth, homeless youth, foster care youth, and that was passed and signed by the governor. So we're going to see what other states might want to take on that legislation as well. So we've got a full plate ahead of us as we move into 2017 and kind of uncharted territory. But the Trevor Project's been around for almost 18 years through lots of different times, and we are going to continue to be there, and we're going to be there for our youth no matter what they need.
And that, I have to ask the question that I've always wondered but never bothered to research. Does the name Trevor Project come from that adorable short film, Trevor?
It does.
It does. Okay,
it does.
Good.
It does. We were so lucky, those folks, Peggy Reisky, James Lucene, and Randy Stone, when that film aired on HBO, they knew to have a number for young people to call, and that's how the Trevor Project became.
Okay, and very quick, what is that number?
The number to call is 866-488-7386. 866-488-7386.
And thetrevorproject.org.
.org. Thank you.
Abby Land, Executive Director of the Trevor Project, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V, Carol Myers, and Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with double thanks again this week to Steve Pride. Bernadette Peters and Sisters in the Pit performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, the Gay Chemist Support Fund of Horizons Foundation, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGHI Westport, Washington, CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba, WRPI Troy, New York, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The utility company that operates the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan has announced that radiation levels from one of the reactors that melted down in 2011 are astoundingly high, way higher than what was measured at the time of the Fukushima meltdown. It may be that such levels have been unmeasured until now, but it illustrates the continuing dangers of radiation. Timothy Jorgensen believes that, rather than leaving things to experts, people should inform themselves about the greater and lesser risks of radiation. He's Associate Professor of Radiation Medicine and Director of the Health Physics and Radiation Protection Graduate Program at Georgetown University. And he's written a book on the matter, which is titled Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, and is published by Princeton University Press. When I spoke with him recently, I asked him to talk about when radiation's harmful effects were first discovered.
So radiation's health effects were discovered very shortly after it was discovered. And it was discovered, X-rays were discovered in 1895. And the people who were working with X-rays, primarily physicists at the time, noted that their hands were getting burned when they were working with X-ray beams. And that was the first indication that X-rays could do something harmful to the body. So shortly after that, people who were grossly overexposed started getting big sores on their hands. A few years later, it was discovered that places where these sores appeared, some of them ultimately developed into cancers. So it wasn't very long after radiation was discovered that it was known that it could damage tissues and produce cancer.
And what were the initial theories about how radiation did the damage that it did?
Well, it wasn't clear at all early on how radiation damaged things. It was this mysterious type of ray. In fact, that's why it was originally called an X-ray, because they didn't know anything about it. But soon after that, people discovered that when radiation passed through things, it also left some energy in what it passed through, namely tissues. And if it left too much energy, it could actually damage the tissue by burning it. We now know that the most serious type of damage is damage that it does to DNA, because that's the type of damage that can go on to produce cancer. But it was much longer after that before we understood some of these mechanisms. So basically what people did, they just kept the doses low enough so they didn't see any visible burning on their skin. And as long as they didn't see anything visible like that, they considered that to be a safe dose of radiation.
So they didn't really have a notion of the longer-term effects that radiation might do if the acute effects were kept under control.
No, in fact, they thought all of radiation's effects were reversible. So, for example, they thought that if you burned your hands, you could just stop working with radiation for a while. As soon as the burn was gone, you could resume and you were back to square one. Soon after that, they found out that not just skin, but you could also get lower blood counts from being exposed to radiation. But again, they thought if you stopped working and your blood counts returned to normal, you essentially were back to ground zero and you could continue working. So that's the way people work with it. They didn't appreciate that there was any kind of cumulative damage. They thought it was a temporary sort of damage that fixed itself, and it wasn't much to worry about since they could obviously see that there was a reversal of this damage.
Obviously, today, radiation, and through the 20th century, has conjured a great amount of fear in the general public. How did the general public react to radiation in the early days to the extent they were aware of it?
Well, shortly after X-rays were discovered, radioactivity was discovered. And radioactivity is actually radiation that comes from the disintegration of atoms. And so the first radioactive elements discovered were discovered by the Curies. They discovered radium and polonium. And radium actually fascinated people. It was this idea that a substance could emit energy was very appealing, and people could see what radium was doing, because in the early days they used to mix radium with fluorescent paint. and use it to illuminate things. And there was a famous case where radium dial painters would paint the dials of watches with this fluorescent radium impregnated paint. And when you turned off the lights in the room, the dial would glow in the dark. Now, I know that today we have fluorescent dials that glow in the dark, but they work by a different principle. Basically, they absorb visible light, and then when you turn off the light, they give it back. But these dials didn't require any light exposure. It was the radium itself, the radioactivity itself, that caused the dials to illuminate. And these were very hot items. These were the iPhones of the day. Everybody wanted one of these. And ironically, though, shortly after that, it turned out that the women who painted these dials were coming down with all kinds of bizarre bone diseases. And it was ultimately traced to the fact that they were eating the radium. The reason they were eating the radium is because they used to paint the watch dials with paintbrushes, and the brushes would get blunted, as you would expect. And so they would twist the edge of the brush in the corner of their mouth to point the brush. And in doing so, they ingested a little bit of paint, and over a course of a year, they had ingested a considerable amount of radium paint. And radium, chemically, is very similar to calcium, and our bones are made of calcium. So the radium went right to our bones. Our bodies mistook the radium for calcium, and in the bones, the radium delivered a whopping dose to these women, and they came down with terrible bone necroses and bone cancers and things like that. And this was widely publicized, and that was the first time that the public became acutely aware that eating radioactivity was not good at all. So that was a major turning point in the public's attitude about the safety of radiation and radioactivity.
Were there any consequences to public health of people wearing these watches? I mean, clearly, as you write in the book, workers tend to be the canaries in the coal mine for any kind of environmental health exposure, since they'll have it in the highest doses. But was there any way to track whether those people who wore these watches had any effects from the radium painted on them?
Well, inside the watch, the radium is contained inside the watch, and so there's very little radiation that escaped from the watch. The real danger from the watches was actually ingesting the radium. So since the customers didn't eat the watches or any part of the watches, they were really not at risk. It was the people who made the watches that were at risk. But an interesting side point to that is that some people believe that radium, because it emitted energy, would be beneficial to health, and so they basically put radium in health drinks, and so these types of health drinks were pretty popular at the time, and there were some notable examples of people eating huge quantities of this, and they came down with symptoms similar to the radium watch dial painters. So, and it's a shame because, like I said, the scientists knew that radium went to bone. They suspected that there was these problems, but there wasn't any FDA or anything like that at the time, and all kinds of charlatans made up stories about what radium could do for you, and were putting it in all types of products, and the public did suffer some from these scams.
Well, speaking of regulation, to what degree after the fallout, which became quite public, of the poisoning with radium of the women who painted the radium dials of the watches, to what degree did that growing awareness of the dangers of radiation lead to regulation from the state, and how did that regulation change with time as the awareness of radiation's dangers changed?
Well, as people became aware that radiation could be harmful, there was great interest in determining a safe dose. So it's the dose that determines how much risk is involved. And you couldn't abolish radiation and radioactivity from society. It had already become essential. So X-rays, I'd just like to mention that very shortly after X-rays were discovered, within a month or so, they were used in diagnostic X-rays, and within a month or so, they were also used to treat cancer, and successfully. So tumors were being shrunk with the use of x-rays. And so no one wanted to go back to no x-rays. The issue was how much radiation could be sustained and still not have any danger involved. At the time, there was this idea that, as I've already mentioned, that things could be reversible. And so that there was the initial standards had to do with reddening of skin. So if you had enough radiation that it reddened your skin, that was considered too much, and so they would back off to a dose that would not redden skin. And it was believed that as long as you didn't have visible effects like that, you were in the clear. So that was the basis. It was called an erythema dose. So that was the basis for the first standards, an erythema dose, to keep things below a dose that would cause irritation to the skin. In terms of ingesting radioactivity, that was more difficult. A lot of the data from the radium dial painters was examined by numerous scientific committees, and eventually they came up with it's interesting because the scientific committee, which was, of course, at the time composed of all men, they came up with the wife or daughter criteria. Basically, they asked the committee members to decide which level, based on the data, which level of radioactivity they would feel safe with their wife or daughter eating. So that was partly a scientific criteria, but that was supposed to be, by putting it in terms of someone that was near and dear to the scientist, that was supposedly going to give the highest level of protection. So the initial standards were based on that. Later on, as we became better able at quantitating doses and as the mechanism of radiation damage to cells and tissues became apparent, we came up with more scientific rationales based on acceptable levels of risk. But in the early days, it was quite difficult to come up with these standards.
Well, Timothy Jorgensen, as you write in your book, Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, with time, scientists realized that different types of radiation have different deleterious health effects, and that the place of the body that one is exposed to radiation has a lot to do with the level of risk of developing illness. Starting with the first one, the varied effects of different types of radiation, can you explain to us why all forms of radiation are not equal in terms of effects on the body?
Yeah, so the biggest divide between types of radiation are the ionizing and the non-ionizing radiation. So you can think of it this way. As radiation energies increase, they get to the point that that energy is sufficient enough that it can actually break chemical bonds. And in doing that, they produce ions. And so at this level of energy, anything higher than that, we have a lot of damage to molecules, all types of molecules, including biological molecules. And we call radiations with this high level of energy ionizing radiations because they ionize molecules. And that would be things like x-rays, gamma rays, things like that. Below this, radiations don't have enough energy to break chemical bonds. And we think that breaking chemical bonds is necessary for to have their biological effects. So these types of radiations, they don't have enough energy to break chemical bonds, so it's unclear how, if any, these types of radiations could have biological effects.
What about the place of exposure in the body, and what effect does that have? To what degree does that limit or broaden the danger that radiation poses to our health?
Well, we talk about whole body exposures. That's where every tissue of the body is exposed. And then we talk about partial body exposures, where only certain tissues are exposed. And I've already alluded to that when I talked about the radium dial painters. Because radium mimics calcium in its chemistry, this radioactivity went exclusively to their bones. So the bones are getting the entire dose from the radioactivity. And the problem with bones is that inside your bones is your bone marrow. And so in addition to the bone cells themselves being irradiated, marrow produces blood. So if you irradiate the skeleton, the bones, you also are going to have an effect on bone development, but also you're going to have an effect on blood formation. And so this is the scenario with partial body exposures like that, that you're going to get a specific effect that's related to the tissues that are being exposed. Other sensitive tissues in the body are, for example, are the thyroid gland. So the thyroid gland is of concern because it can, as part of its normal function, it concentrates iodine. And so if that iodine happens to be radioactive, as iodine-131 is, then you will have a big concentration of radioactivity in your thyroid gland, and consequently a high thyroid dose, and consequently an increased risk of thyroid cancer. So other parts of the body that are more sensitive are anything where cells are replicating very quickly. So that's why people, if they have a radiation therapy to their head, their hair will fall out because those hair follicle cells are killed. If you have radiation to your gut, there are rapidly growing cells that are within your small intestines, and they are damaged by the radiation because cells that are rapidly dividing tend to be vulnerable to radiation. So the exact organ and tissue that's irradiated is going to be very a large determinant about as to what types of health effects you're going to see.
But to be clear, so when you're talking about the risk that parts of your body might suffer from radiation, for you to have an elevated risk of thyroid cancer, you're not saying that specifically the thyroid was exposed to the radiation. You're saying that the kind of form of radiation that maybe one ingested or breathed in particularly was receptive, say it contained iodine, to that particular organ. Is that right?
So I'm saying two things. First of all, for the organ to be damaged by radiation, the organ has to have been exposed to some radiation dose. And that radiation dose, if it relates to ingesting radioactivity, will be largely determined by the fate of that radioactivity in the body. And different types of radioactivity tend to go to different organs. So if you expose your foot, you're not going to get thyroid cancer because the thyroid itself has to be exposed. So how could it be exposed? It could be exposed because you had an X-ray of your thyroid, or it could be exposed because you somehow ingested radioactive iodine. But the dose has to be delivered to the thyroid for the thyroid to be at risk. So that's the fundamental principle, that the organ has to have been exposed to a certain dose, and in order to be at risk. And the risk level is dependent upon the dose level. So if you double the dose, you double the risk.
Molecular radiation biologist Timothy Jorgensen is my guest. He is the author of Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, which is published by Princeton University Press. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I'd like to ask you about radiation as a cancer treatment and the origins of using radiation therapy. Clearly, as you've mentioned already, there was a growing awareness that radiation could seriously damage or kill off the cells or mutate the cells of the body. How did radiation therapy then emerge, given that earlier conclusion of the dangers of radiation?
Well, this is actually quite a fascinating story in that as soon as X-rays were discovered, within a couple of weeks they were used in therapy. And the reason for this is that X-rays were discovered as coming from something called a Crookes tube. And I really can't get into the details of a Crookes tube here, but it was something that physicists had. It looked like a light bulb. And when you put high voltages across it, it glowed in the dark, and physicists were trying to figure out why that was happening. And through an accident of fate, one scientist, Wilhelm Röntgen in Germany, he discovered that there was something coming out of these tubes that could move through matter. And when he held his hand up to block these invisible things, he saw the shadows of his bones on a fluorescent screen. And so this is what prompted him to publish. Well, these Crookes tubes were all over the world. All physicists were playing with these Crookes tubes trying to figure out how they worked. In fact, it ended up two Nobel Prizes were awarded for work done on Crookes tubes. But it turns out, just coincidentally, that there was a medical student in Chicago who was working in a Crookes tube factory to pay for his way through medical school, and he noticed when he worked with these Crookes tubes that his hands got burned, just as I said earlier, that the X-rays tended to burn hands. And he immediately concluded that his hands were being burned by the X-rays as soon as he found out about Röntgen's discovery. He said, oh, the X-rays must be burning my hands. So when he went to school the next day, he told this to his professors, and they said, well, if X-rays can burn normal tissue, perhaps we can use them to burn out cancerous tumors. So the very next day, they had a breast cancer patient, and they tried exposing. They actually brought the patient down to the Crookes tube factory, and they treated her tumor with X-rays. It turns out they gave her 18 treatments, and her tumor shrunk. Well, you can imagine what a sensation this was at this time. We're talking 1896. There were no treatments for cancer other than terribly disfiguring surgeries. So this was absolutely amazing. And doctors from all over the city started sending patients to this medical student who was working out of a Crookes tube factory. And from there, it spread around the world, and pretty soon doctors all over were starting to treat cancers with X-rays, not knowing exactly how they worked, only that knowing that they did, in fact, shrink tumors. And so from the time X-rays were discovered to the time the first patient was treated was just 30 days. That's how rapidly this technology got into the clinic. It's something that you could scarcely see today, that anything would move from bench to bedside that quickly.
And at what point was there an awareness that with radiation therapy that there was a risk involved, maybe not an enormous one if it was balanced against the fact that there were no cancer treatments at the time, but that there was a risk involved in using radiation as a therapy for cancer?
Well, as I said, it was... For the people who use it on a day-to-day basis, they knew that there were risks of burning themselves and also risk of hurting the patients. And it wasn't long before they started constructing shields that shielded normal tissue so that only the tumor area would be exposed. They would make these out of, like, lead foils and things like that to protect the patients. So the idea was to concentrate the radiation in the tumor where you could see the beneficial effect and not irradiate anything that wasn't going to benefit from the radiation, namely the normal tissue. But in terms of the patients, the primary risk to the patient was that they were going to die from the tumor that they had now. They weren't too much concerned about skin burns, which were being treated with petroleum jelly, and the risk of getting a cancer in the future, because their immediate concern was the cancer that they had now. So from their standpoint, the risks were worth, the benefits far outweighed the risk. In terms of the workers, there was a doctor and a dentist up in Boston who made extensive studies into how to limit the exposure of workers to radiation. And they made like a box with a shutter on it so that the X-rays wouldn't irradiate everyone in the room. They were careful to stand far away from the X-ray tube when it was turned on. And they actually published a book that sold out immediately and was in multiple editions that went around the world to all the people that were using X-rays, mostly doctors and dentists at the time, telling them about the safe use of X-rays. You know, not everybody heeded this advice. These two brothers actually lived well into their 80s, even though they worked with X-rays their whole lives. But others had had some terrible consequences. Dentists, in particular, many of them lost tips of their fingers because they would actually hold the x-ray films in the patient's mouth every time they took an x-ray. So every x-ray they took, they exposed their finger. So this was unwise, and many of them paid for it by having finger amputations and other unpleasant things like that. People were aware that there were dangers. There were methods to protect people, particularly workers, but not everybody took those precautions, and some suffered the consequences of that.
Well, the question of risk is one of the themes of your book, Strange Glow, and one group of people was particularly aware of the risks because they were scientists who had seen earlier generations of radiation scientists get ill from exposure to radiation, and that is the scientists who were involved in the Manhattan Project put together by the United States to produce the first atomic bomb. And in their case, of course, we're talking about potentially very large doses of radiation. Can you tell us about the concerns that those scientists had as they were working to develop the U.S. bomb?
Yeah, so they had big concerns, and you're right. They had seen the older generation of scientists, some of whom were careless with radiation, suffer the consequences of exposure, and they were worried because there were two things going on. First of all, the atomic bomb scientists were working with concentrations of radioactivity that were unprecedented, and the other thing is they were working with types of radioisotopes that were previously unknown. So they had the double worry here. Suppose these new isotopes have new effects, and suppose these high concentrations of radioactivity give us whopping doses. And so there was something within the Manhattan Project called the Chicago Health Division that was responsible for protecting the workers. And they didn't have a lot of understanding about how radiation affected health, and their general principle was that they were just going to keep doses as low as they possibly could. For radioisotopes, radioactivity, basically no internal exposure was considered acceptable, so they developed all types of ways to prevent people from eating it or breathing it. It was considered, their limit was zero on that. And for external exposure to radiation, which they couldn't make it zero, they tightly regulated it. Everybody had to wear two dosimeters, and they would always take the higher. A dosimeter is an instrument that you wear that measures your radiation dose. They make people wear two, and then they assume that the lower one was wrong and that the higher one was right. And when people started getting levels of dose that were of concern, they would rotate them off that job. So there was vigorous efforts to protect the workers, and largely because they didn't really understand what was going on. So nevertheless, there were some accidents, and criticality accidents. Criticality is when you have so much uranium in one place that it can cause a chain reaction. So that happened a couple of times, and that was accidents, and they were accidents that happened because people disregarded safety precautions, and those people were massively overdosed in these criticality accidents and ended up dying. So those were tragic things that happened during the course of Manhattan Projects. So it was a big concern, and a lot of effort was put to protect people.
And, of course, the most tragic result of the Manhattan Project was eventually the development of the bombs that got dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so much of what has come to be understood about radiation and its effect on human health comes out of the follow-up to what happened to people who were the victims of those bombings. Can you tell us about what was ultimately learned, bearing in mind that what killed the most people initially was not the radiation, but the shock waves and the incendiary fires that came from these two nuclear bombs, and then radiation was then poisoned those who survived?
Yes. So the atomic bombs, of course, were an awful event that shocked the entire world. And we think atomic bomb, we think radiation, people were killed with radiation. But you're correct. You're absolutely correct. Most people died in those bombings from the percussive effects and the fire produced by the bombs. So 75-80% of the people that were killed by the atomic bombs were killed in that way, and that's the way conventional bombs kill, percussive effects and fires. It was only the people that escaped the percussive effects and fires that suffered, that were alive to suffer the radiation effects. And so since we have learned largely about the effects of the atomic bomb from those survivors, we tend to think of bombs killing with radiation. But we need to remember that these bombs primarily kill, like all other bombs do, by just blowing things apart. So this radiation was an added dimension that other bombs didn't have. And so people who were exposed to the radiation from the bomb, this was a rather unique situation, because here was the first time where we had large numbers of people that were exposed over their whole bodies to uniform doses of radiation. And the other thing about this is that we knew, we were later able to determine very precisely what the doses these people received were, because the radiation came from the center, ground zero spot, and it emanated out from there. And just as everyone knows where they were when the Twin Towers were attacked, 9/11, everybody knew who was in Hiroshima exactly where they were standing when the atomic bomb went off. And because they could relate that information to scientists, the scientists could calculate exactly what dose they received. So this, in the aftermath of the bombing, this provided an opportunity, a tragic opportunity, but an opportunity to determine what the risk levels were for any particular dose. And so since that time, since the 1940s up to till this present day, the survivors of the atomic bomb, and there still are many survivors of the atomic bomb, are being studied. They're being studied at a research center in Hiroshima, Japan, as to the health consequences. And so we've been following these people, and so we have people at all different doses, and we see what happens to them later in life. Primarily, the issue is an increased risk of cancer, and we can, because of these people, determine what the risk of cancer per unit dose is. So this is an amazing study. It's really unlike any other study that has happened in epidemiology. It's called a cohort study. It's a large ongoing cohort study, and we've gotten very accurate information about radiation risk from those studies. And now, today, instead of needing a wife or daughter standard that I mentioned earlier, or an erythema standard based on burning of hands, we have standards that are based on the risk levels that were calculated from the Hiroshima survivors. So we owe a debt of gratitude to these people who have been willing for their whole lives to come in on a regular basis to health clinics in Japan and allow scientists to study them in terms of the long-term consequences of radiation. They didn't have to do it. They're volunteers. And they've tremendously helped, through their very unfortunate situation, the rest of the world come up with standards for radiation protection.
Well, were there any surprises that were learned from the consequences for these survivors? In terms of, I mean, obviously radiation kills people. Obviously, large doses of radiation elevates the risk of cancer. Lower doses may not elevate it to the same degree, although in terms of mutations, even low doses can lead to mutations.
Well, the biggest surprise at the time is now that we have so much focus on cancer, it may be hard to understand, but at that time, the focus on the health effects was not on cancer. The focus was on genetic effects. So people were aware because of, Darwin and other works on mutagenesis, that people could harbor mutations and pass them on to their progeny. And it was believed that radiation mutated the germ cells in the body, and therefore you could pass horrible mutations on to your children. And so people were most concerned about that. So the initial effort was to find these mutated children, because it was scary for people, because what this meant is that you didn't even have to be exposed to the radiation yourself. You just had to have the misfortune of marrying someone who was exposed to radiation and having children that were deformed because of their prior exposure. So that was the emphasis. So the surprising thing was that the Hiroshima bomb study didn't find mutants. They're still looking for them. They have not found these mutants. It turns out that the frequency of producing mutations like that, that transmissible mutations from generation to generation, is very, very low. What they did find were the cancers, and they found more cancers than they expected, and fewer or no genetic effects. And so the focus of the study changed over time to being more a cancer study than anything else. And also something that was not known at the time, but is now appreciated, is that all tissues of the body are considered to be at risk for cancer from radiation. And it wasn't clear at the time that all tissues were susceptible, but now we believe that all tissues are susceptible. So if they have received a dose, they are susceptible to cancer. So now the study has largely been determining the cancer risk for specific tissues, and less so for the genetics, because there hasn't been any genetic mutants found.
Molecular radiation biologist Timothy Jorgensen is my guest. We'll return with him in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm talking to the author of Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation. His name is Timothy Jorgensen, and he's Associate Professor of Radiation Medicine and Director of the Health, Physics, and Radiation Protection Graduate Program at Georgetown University. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, another instance where, very sadly, human beings were, in effect, the guinea pigs for the effects of radiation happened in the post-war era in the Pacific, with the United States testing the hydrogen bomb. Can you tell us what was learned from that sad experience in terms of the danger of fallout for the residents of the Marshall Islands and Bikini Atoll and other Pacific Islanders exposed to radioactive fallout?
Yeah, so fallout is when radioactivity mixes with dust particles in the sky, gets into clouds, and then largely settles back down to Earth. And so that's our definition of fallout. So you're being exposed to radioactivity that's coming down from the sky. So there was very little fallout in the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. And the reason for this is that the bombs were detonated high above the ground. They were not detonated at ground level. And so since they were detonated in the sky, they did not kick up huge clouds of dust. And the radioactivity that was released largely just dissipated and blew out to sea and never came back down on the population. So the Hiroshima and Nagasaki situations are unique in that the people suffer just from the blast of radiation, the radiation coming from the bomb itself. But when bombs were tested later in primarily the Bikini Atolls, which is a chain of islands in the Marshall Islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, very isolated region. That's why it was chosen for atomic bomb testing. These bombs were tested at ground level. And they were also larger bombs, much larger bombs. And so they kicked up fallout into the sky. And even though they were aware of the possibility of that happening and had evacuated some islands, unfavorable weather conditions blew the fallout to areas that they, beyond where they expected it to fall. And this is the first time that humans encountered people who had... that mankind had encountered people who had been exposed to very high levels of fallout. And so we learned about fallout effects from those people, from the Marshall Islanders. And this is how we first learned about iodine-131. Iodine-131 fell down on these islanders. It got incorporated into the foods they eat, and so they got high doses of radiation to their thyroid, and consequently they started coming down with thyroid cancers. There were also new compounds like strontium. It turns out that strontium behaves like radium chemically, and so strontium went to the bone, and many of those islanders suffered some of the same consequences that had been seen with the radium watch dial painters. So we learned a tremendous amount about fallout. So these people had not been exposed to the blast effects. They had just been exposed to the fallout. So this is another unique population that has been studied for many years for the consequences of fallout. And from them, we learned a lot about how radioactivity in the body behaves. And this is relevant even today, because the types of radioisotopes that are released by nuclear bombs are similar to the types of radioisotopes that are produced in nuclear power plants. So if you have a nuclear power plant accident or leak, you're going to see the same types of radioisotopes, not at the same levels, hopefully, but the same types. And so we can determine from the Marshall Islanders what levels of radioactivity are expected to cause problems and what type of cancer levels to see and all that from the studies that were done in the Marshall Islands.
Well, so following up with that then, in 2011, there was the nuclear reactor meltdown in Fukushima in Japan. And the question of the consequences of that in some ways are still not entirely understood. But what has been identified in terms of the risk for people in Japan and in that in the immediate vicinity of the Fukushima reactor?
So Fukushima, as you know, resulted in reactor meltdowns and release of radioactivity into the environment. This is the second time we've seen something on that scale, and the first time was Chernobyl. So the information that we can get to inform us about health consequences in Japan is coming from first, the Marshall Islanders, but secondarily from what we know happened in Chernobyl. The chief concern is cancer to the thyroid, because in Chernobyl we saw a significant amount of thyroid cancer, particularly for children. But the situation in Japan is quite different. First of all, the Chernobyl accident was much, much larger than the Fukushima accident. So much, much more radioactivity was released into the environment. The second thing is that people were not told in Chernobyl what was going on. And so they there was a period of time where people were eating and drinking and consuming locally grown produce and other foodstuffs, and were exposing themselves before they even knew what was going on. And the other thing about the people in Chernobyl is they had iodine-deficient diets, which meant that their thyroids were absolutely starved for iodine. So this was the triple whammy, okay? Very, very large amounts of radioactivity released to the environment, continuing to eat foodstuffs in the local area, and having thyroids that were starved for iodine. So that largely, those things together contributed to a significant increase in thyroid cancer to the Chernobyl people.
We mentioned with Chernobyl that people continued to eat local produce versus in Fukushima. How long is local produce contaminated? You write in the book specifically about dairy products and how dairy tends to accumulate dangerous substances.
Yeah, so the dairy is a concern for the iodine-131. So iodine-131 has a half-life of 8 days. So the reason it's a concern is because it comes down to the ground as fallout. It gets incorporated into grass. The grass gets eaten by cows. It gets into the milk, and it ends up in dairy products. So the good thing about the iodine-131 is it has a half-life of 8 days, which means that every 8 days there's only half as much as there was before. So if you carry this out to, five, six half-lives, you can see that in a couple of months, virtually all of it is gone. So if you can keep people from eating the local dairy products primarily, but other produce as well, for a period of a couple of months, basically that problem has solved itself because the radioactivity has all decayed away. So there's no longer any threat from iodine-131 from the Fukushima accident. All of that radioactivity is long gone.
Well, let me end by asking you where we should be concerned in terms of risk, because what you've basically been arguing, and you argue in Strange Glow, is that radiation has risks. Radiation is also with us in terms of X-rays are going to continue in our lives. One can have debates clearly about nuclear power, and with Donald Trump, perhaps that's going to increase, but that radiation, whatever its dangers, isn't something that's just going to disappear, and that we as lay people should are capable of making assessments about risk and exposure and the degree to which we elect or don't elect to be exposed. Obviously, being next to a nuclear power plant that melts down, we don't have much choice over that. But more broadly speaking, there are some decisions that we can make. So bearing that in mind, and if you can answer in as briefly as possible with this large question, where are the risks that we should be concerned with?
Okay, so I've been a little more opinionated in this radio interview than I am in the book, actually. In the book takes a slightly different angle on things. It tries to describe radiation, what it does, what its health consequences are, and also to measure and quantify both the risks and the benefits. And it leaves to the reader to decide which risks they want to worry about and which they don't. So the problem is that everybody's risk tolerance is not the same. So what's acceptable to one person may be totally unacceptable to another. So it doesn't really work telling people this you should worry about and this you shouldn't. They have to decide that for themselves. And so that's the approach I've taken in the book, try to explain how these risks are calculated, what the risk levels are, what the benefits are, and let people decide on an individual basis. So one of the things that I delve into in the book in terms of things that might be riskier than people had thought, for example, are I talk about diagnostic radiography, and there's two different worlds of diagnostic radiography. There's one where people come in and they have a suspect disease and they're using an X-ray or some other radiation technology to find out what's wrong with them. And in those cases, the benefits are Very high, and the risks are usually extremely low. But in other cases, we talk about the worried well. They might subscribe to some of these commercial endeavors. You don't really see this too much in academic medical centers, but you do see it in private facilities where you get a whole body scan. When you're absolutely, they're screening for a disease, so they'll give you an entire body scan from head to toe with a spiral CT scan device looking for disease. Well, the person came in with no symptoms of disease. You've scanned their whole body. Their whole body has now gotten a dose of radiation, and there's no proven benefit from doing this. So I think that consumers need to think about some of these issues going in and make individual decisions whether they want to subject themselves to such whole body screening when they don't have any other symptoms of disease, or whether they want to use radiation more judiciously to find the cause of disease that they have symptoms with. And so that would be my recommendation to people. Understand the risks going in and make a decision for yourself whether you want to have that procedure, whether you want to live next to a nuclear power plant, whether you want to worry about nuclear bombs, whether you want to worry about the radioactivity in the food you eat. Understand what the risks are and make your own decision.
I've been speaking with Timothy Jorgensen. He is a molecular radiation biologist based at Georgetown University, author of Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, which is published by Princeton University Press. Timothy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.